welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 211, and we've got the whole crew back, starting with James Jones.
Hi.
John Lindemann.
Yay, yay.
Greg Lay.
Hello.
And I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. So good to be back. This is the Metroid Free podcast.
Thank God.
I hope you enjoyed last week's episode. We got it out of our systems.
But this podcast is brought to you by Metroid Other M.
I wish it were. Then we'd have some money coming in. God.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in some ways, we were pretty harsh on it, you know. But anyway, we've had, John and James have had 2 weeks to play games and talk about them, and that's what they're going to do.
And it's gone horribly.
James, what you got?
So, just to give the quick recap of where I left off last time, I spoke poorly about Tales of Innocence. I completed it. Took 47 hours.
God.
Which for a DS game is unfathomable.
Not unfathomable. I've played Dragon Quest IX more than that, and I'm only like 2/3 through it.
So. Yeah, but that's so much more of an open-ended game than this is.
Yes.
While the game was auto-grinding, which is the greatest feature of the Tales series.
What? Auto-grinding? What is that?
You can turn battles on full auto mode, so all the characters are controlled by the AI.
Uh-huh.
And if you stand on a save point, you'll heal at the end of every battle.
You really would like Final Fantasy 13, James. I know I've said it like half a dozen times, but...
I didn't particularly appreciate the fact I needed to auto-grind, but...
And the thing is, you don't really need to in Final Fantasy 13, but anyway... The battles are highly automated if you want them to be, and you automatically refill everything after each battle.
While that was going on, I played Banjo-Tooie HD, which I downloaded off the 360.
So you were playing that while the
game was playing itself. Yes. I had
you're playing two video games at once.
I had Tales on low volume, so I knew when battle started, and then I could sort of babysit it while it was going.
You're like a WoW player. Like you watch movies and shit while you play your RPGs.
It was not how I ideally would have played that game, but it became a necessity, and I did not want to sit there and grind. So I let the game do it by itself.
So Banjo-Tooie, we might be talking about this more in the near future, but what are your kind of... Did you play it back on the N64?
Oh, God, yes.
Okay.
I mean, that was during the era where if you owned an N64, you had to play it because...
I don't think so. I think a lot of people had moved on to, like, Dreamcast or other things by then.
There's a reason I'm playing this game, but I'll delve into that at some other time. But I actually much preferred this game to Banjo-Kazooie at the time. And mm-hmm. I still believe that's the case. For whatever reason, it's not as well regarded, I think, as its predecessor. But it's a superior game. I mean,
it's a lot more protracted. And I think by that time, maybe people's patience for 3D platformers was wearing out a little bit because the genre had been so saturated for that particular generation of consoles.
But especially the N64. I mean, Nintendo put out one. Rare put out four.
I mean, they're all very similar, too.
Between them, they put out 5 3D platformers that have a lot of similarities. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the companies like Ubisoft were pumping them out, too. I mean, a bunch of companies.
There was a Rayman game that bore similarities as a hybrid between Mario 64 and some of the traits of Rare platformers.
Yeah, well, you remember Tonic Trouble?
Vaguely.
Remember Gex 3?
Oh, yes. I remember everything about Gex 3.
There was so much.
I own Gex 3, thank you very much.
There were so many 3D platformers.
It's not exactly a thing to be particularly proud of, so I can hear his smart-ass comments about everything he does. It's great. What I'm surprised by, though, is that Banjo-Tooie, relatively speaking, has aged pretty well. I kind of thought it was going to have aged poorly. Now, I think if I was playing the N64 version on the LCD TV, it would probably look terrible.
Well, and also, technically, it was pushing the N64 a bit too far. There's some really big open spaces where the frame rate just really starts chundering along quite brutally.
Chundering? You made that up.
As in throwing up is actually what that means.
Wow.
What's strange about the game, though, is I remember a lot of the stages being really big. So Mayan Mayhem, I think, is the name of the stage in Quest, the first stage.
It's like the first big
level. It's the very first stage. Yeah. I remember the area around the temples being huge, And then when I actually go back and play them, I'm like, wow, this area is tiny. Yeah. It's like you compare it to what we get now, and you're like, this is really small.
I did have that experience where I played a bit of the first Banjo once. I went back to the first world of that.
Yes.
And you could get I got 9 jiggies in 20 minutes or something.
You're like, what the hell's going on here? I just remember thinking, wow, this is really compact after Galaxy 1. Or even Sunshine. The worlds are
Well, one of the big things with the Banjo games is that you'd have the jiggies just sort of strewn about, and you didn't warp out of the level.
No,
when
you just
collected
got them.
So unlike Mario, where it would force you to go back to the castle
right.
in 64, or of course, yeah, with Galaxy, it's really quite linear and all that. It isn't so open worldy anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can really rack them up quick, especially if you've got some residual memory of where they were.
Yeah, I think that's preferable. Actually, I think it makes the game feel more fluid. I mean, it doesn't really make sense why Mario leaves and then comes back.
Well, in some cases, it has to do with scripting of the levels.
I know. I mean, it makes technical sense, but I mean, logically, it's like, why would he just go, well, I'm near where the next star is, but fuck it, I'm going to head back out.
I think the conceit is he has to deliver the star back to the castle.
Yeah, I guess.
I think it's just that awkward middle ground that 64 occupied between, oh, it's kind of open-ended exploration, but we've still got some kind of scripted elements to different stars.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
Galaxy's much more just all the way to the scripted linear part, so
it
feels more natural.
Some of the puzzles in Banjo-Tooie are actually tricky. I mean, I don't really remember how I solved a bunch of them back then. And I remember there's a level, and I won't get into too much detail, there's a level Grunty Industries. I remember I hated that level, but I couldn't remember why. And then I got there, and I'm like, oh, because I can't get inside. How the hell do you get in? And it took forever to remember how the hell you get into that stupid level. So I just spent 20 minutes walking around going, open the damn door. I just want to go in.
Yeah, I remember Banjo-Tooie being a really quintessential example of the philosophy back then, which was that 3D platforming itself, the actual straight platforming, wasn't interesting enough to withstand a whole game. And so basically they just had to add in so much variety. You know, it was different mission objectives and mini games and characters and different mm-hmm. play styles, and now you're racing and
first person shooting. I mean, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, there's the multiplayer first person shooting in Tooie, isn't there?
Yes. I think the interesting thing about Tooie, though, is that it actually stays on the ground much more than its predecessor. There's not a lot of fly pads scattered about.
Yeah,
there are whole levels that just don't have any. And you're like, damn, I'm collecting a lot of red feathers for not a lot of reasons. I don't know. Some of them really, there's a Jiggy over there, and I see another one over here, and you just go get one and come back and get the other. And I kind of like that. I kind of like the fact that I can bust through levels quickly. I mean, I made it to level 7 in 7 hours, which isn't bad.
And that's getting towards the end.
I think there's 2 more.
Yeah, no, it's something like 9, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I guess can you comment on the Xbox Live Arcade version, because I think I might have played a demo of it really quickly, but does it run well? Does it look good?
It runs very well. It's up-resed, but they didn't really put in any new textures or anything. They're just bigger. But it actually looks surprisingly good. I mean, it looks like an N64 game, but the art style actually works pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
There's no extra polygons or anything. I mean, the models are the models, but they look fine. I think Rare did a really good job with the game, and then the company that they had port it did a pretty good job themselves and didn't screw things up. And like Greg said, there is some serious chugging going on in the N64 version.
I believe the word he used was chundering.
Yeah. I know that's the word he used.
You can imagine the rhythm of vomit exiting someone's body.
Oh my god.
That is what
it's
I'm
so
trying
evocative.
To
remember. Oh, no. Something like that.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's
an onomatopoeia.
It's much more smooth than the initial version of the game.
I learn something new every week during the show. All right, so John, I know what you've been. I've seen you on Xbox Live.
Oh, are you watching me, Johnny? You
with
sly
the
dog.
Camera.
I've seen you. You've been playing this Netflix game all the time.
You know what big new game's coming out on Xbox Live when all of a sudden I have 15 friends on all of a sudden?
Yeah, I got suckered into buying Halo Reach.
You got suckered into it?
Suckered
by
into it. Hey, it's not me. It's the hype, man. I'm a victim.
And John, you're not a real big fan of Halo.
No, not really.
No, I hate them, but damn it, they got me again.
Just games like that. It's like, see, the thing is each year I figure that there's one big super hyped game that will suck me in. And the thing is with Halo, though, I've had this happen in past years with Madden, where I'll be like, you know, I'm going to get into Madden this year. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to play it every day.
This is the year.
this is going to be it, right? I'm going to put my flag in the ground. I'm going to take Madden all the way. And then I buy it, and I'm like, this is fucking Madden. The funny thing with sports games now, just as an aside, it's like sports games are now like, they remind me of MMOs now, where like, really, that's the only game you really should play if you're going to even get your money's worth out of it.
Yeah.
So, hold on. Before we continue, gentlemen, what do you want to place bets on John having this exact same conversation when Black Ops comes out about being the one game this year he got sucked into by the hype?
No, see, Black Ops, I am legitimately not interested in.
Oh.
Legitimately. And I mean it this time.
That is going in the meet the press vault for when...
How do you feel about Halo Reach then?
Well, okay, the thing is, right, I was like, you know, I wasn't really hyped for it, but, you know, I saw some reviews, and there was a couple things in it that kind of interested me. The one thing is that they have a loadout for your character, sort of like Modern Warfare does. It's cribbed some elements from Modern Warfare. And bear in mind that I didn't play ODST. I had zero interest in that game.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not too sure exactly what has been carried over from ODST.
Well, in terms of multiplayer, everything's new. In Reach, because ODST had the same multiplayer as 3. It was like cross-compatible with it.
Yeah, so now you can go in and you can earn in-game currency, which, and the cool thing about that, I mean, that's been done in a lot of other first-person shooters with online play, but you also get, even for playing through the single-player portion of the game, you get in-game currency that you can use to buy like new armor and new helmets and all kinds of stuff like that, so you can kind of customize your character, which is pretty cool, which it really makes sense because, you know, you always put a lot of time in all of these first-person shooters. They at least have a cursory single-player game that you inevitably play through. And a lot of times, you know, there's just really no reason to play through it outside of probably unlocking something or something like that. And this takes that to, you know, a much higher level where what you put on your character actually helps you in the single player game as well as online.
You say it helps you, but isn't it all cosmetic stuff?
Well, I have yet to see because even though like I've put some new stuff on my character, it says that it's increased armor and, you know, more protection at the cost of weight and stuff like that. So I have yet to see whether or not, and that's hard to tell, and obviously in the single player game.
Sounds like flavor text.
It very well may be. But anyways, either way, it affects at least the look of your avatar in both single player and multiplayer.
Which is really important in a first person shooter.
Yeah, but, you know, it's neat. I mean, it gives you something else to do aside from just, you know, mindlessly blowing stuff away. And
it
I don't know.
Makes you a better target when the game gets going.
Well, the thing is, if you're going to spend so much time playing a first person shooter, I mean, at least with Modern Warfare, it's, I don't know, sometimes I just wonder how people can play it as long as they do, because it's literally the same thing over and over again. You can't unlock a lot outside of just, you know, leveling up and getting perks and stuff like that. But let's see. I have yet to take it online for multiplayer, but what interests me more is the firefight mode, which has been carried over from ODST.
Yeah, I think they've improved it.
Yeah, they've improved it. And I think you can, from what they were saying, you can go online and kind of compete against other teams in a non-adversarial manner. So if you don't feel like hopping into a deathmatch and getting destroyed by the millions of Halo pros out there, you can hop on with a friend and play co-op. And
unless you have a 4-gig Xbox, then you can't.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Which is apparently a big problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're a Halo fan, it's pretty much it's the best Halo game by a long shot, I think. I thought Halo 3 was good, not great. I think this is better than Halo 3 in terms of being a total package. The one thing I like about it is the phrase that we've often used when we talk about first-person shooters on this podcast is bro-y. And the one thing that always made me laugh about Halo 3 was it was very, very bro-y in the sense that it was like, oh, it's, you know, because, you know, you're playing the role of Master Chief, and everybody's like, there's a lot of, you know, Master Chief nut juggling through that game, like, oh my god, it's Master Chief, you're amazing, you know, like, just all of this kind of like high five, like super high fives for Master Chief through that entire game, which gets kind of ridiculous by the end, like, you know, like, as if like the plot isn't crazy enough as it is, and the enemies aren't as ridiculous as they are. One thing I always thought was funny about Halo was that Master Chief is like such a faceless character, but yet they try to turn him into something that I've never really thought that he was. Like, but in Halo Reach, you really are just a soldier on this team that goes in. They're not trying to build a character necessarily. So, you know, Halo Reach, I think the story kind of makes the characters in the story make more sense. But yeah, I mean, if you're, like I said, if you're not a Halo fan, it's not going to make you a Halo fan. If you are a Halo fan, you'll love it.
Well, you already
haven't played Halo since the first one, which like almost 10 years ago, and I played a little bit of multiplayer. I mean, I had some friends who played it, and I would occasionally pick it up and do a few rounds with them. I was terrible at it.
Yeah.
And then I remember one time I played the campaign for like an hour and didn't enjoy it at all. It was just something about it didn't feel right. But I've actually put Halo Reach at the top of my Gamefly queue because, you know, I want to try it. I don't want to go buy it because I'm afraid that I'm really not, it's not going to work for me. But I do kind of want to give it another shot because, you know, I'm sure the series has come a long way since that time. And jetpacks, man.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I haven't tried those yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
I'm probably going to play Killzone 3 too because of fucking jetpacks.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, that's a pretty surefire way to get me to try a game.
So, let's see. What else have I been playing? I actually picked up one of my Best Buy kind of deals so good I couldn't turn down, much in the vein of Final Fantasy 13, is Bioshock 2. Really not too much to say. Johnny, you've played through Bioshock 2, right?
Yes. I liked it. You know, it was like a fun weekend blow-through rental thing for me.
Yeah, because I got it for like $20, brand new. So I was like, I'm not going to turn that down. And yeah, I mean, there's really not too much to say about it. It is, you're back in Rapture and you're playing as a big daddy. So the one thing I will say about that series is it really wins in terms of its kind of world design. You know, it's a fun sightseeing game. I don't think it's, you know, like I've said about the first game, I don't think it's the greatest first person shooter out there. I think it's overrated.
Yeah, it's definitely not. I think the story stuff is overrated. I think people jizz all over Bioshock because it has a story.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not incompetent like most video games are, but it's not great either.
Yeah.
Read a motherfucking book, you know. Yes. So
Reed Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know if I'd recommend that, but
no, apparently, you know, that is an awful book.
Yeah, I read it recently. I'm not going to get into it, but from a literary standpoint, it is challenging to defend. And it's 1,300 pages, so yeah.
Yeah, it's really long.
You'd be better off playing Bioshock.
Yeah, the abridged version.
Yeah, you get all you wanted to know about
again,
it.
The snake eats his tail.
So I'm looking forward to playing through that. I like Rapture in that world and kind of the backstory to it, so that should be fun.
And your Nintendo Game of the Week is...
Yeah, my Nintendo Game of the Week is 1080 Snowboarding.
Oh, there we go.
1080. This was a game that I don't think I actually owned this on the N64, but my wife, she's a big SSX fan, and of course there are no SSX games on the Wii, which is what she mainly plays. What?
Well, there is one on the Wii, but...
Is there one?
Yeah.
It's from way back.
Yeah, it was almost a launch game. I know Mike Sklins really likes it, but most people don't.
It's the one where you have to draw like weird little shapes for some of the tricks and stuff, which didn't go down so well, but certain other parts of the game were rated better.
Yeah.
The weird thing about SSX is they just abandoned that series. I mean, it was like the hottest shit in the industry, and then, oh, we're not making them anymore.
Yeah, I mean, now all there is... Weird. I mean, all I could find was Shaun White Snowboarding, which I really didn't want to take a flyer on, so...
It's not as good. It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't have the same fun.
Well,
factor.
Mean, the only pro is that you'll only have to wait about 4 days after it comes out to get it for $10.
Yeah, like I figure SSX must be like a coaster somewhere. I'll probably find it in a bar somewhere.
Yeah. Is it Blur? Is that the subtitle?
Blur. Yeah, that's the game.
Okay, I'll look it up.
Some people really like it, but some people hate it. So I don't know.
Yeah. So you know, in a moment of folly, I would describe it as
a moment of passion.
I figured, hey, let's get a snowboarding game off a virtual console. Oh, they have 1080 snowboarding. So I downloaded it, and it has not aged well at all. I mean, the graphics are they're laughable. And at the time, I think the graphics were actually, they were considered to be pretty good, weren't they?
Yeah.
Well, the nice thing about it is that at that time, you know, N64 was known for these really garishly colorful games that made people think they were for children or whatever. And 1080 is a game it's a first party game made in Japan by Nintendo.
Yes.
And it has like more of a realistic look to it. And that was very novel at the time.
Yeah.
So I think that was a big part of it. And the snow effects were really good. I mean, compared to like what you had on PS1, it did look pretty good.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be the realistic snowboarding game too, right?
Yep.
I mean, mechanically.
Yeah, I remember that much.
Because they had a bunch of snowboarders you've never heard of.
Yeah, and I mean, you can tell that also by just the move sets that you have. You have a lot of move sets, but they're all button combos. Like, it's like Tekken. or something. And it's like, it was so funny because I was like, you know, I was trying to figure out how to do some moves, and I was like, man, how the heck do I pull off these moves? Because, you know, you can do like your, like when you hit a ramp, you can squat down and then jump up to kind of get more lift. Mm-hmm. And you can do a twist. And I was like, how the hell do I actually do moves? And so I go and I look at the manual. You know, every single move is like four different buttons combined. I'm like, come on. And yeah. And I mean, it's I really lost patience with it pretty quickly. Because, and also what's interesting now, and James touched on this a little earlier, was how few, like how the depth of what you used to get in games back then in terms of features, like feature set. Like I looked at, so I, you know, I looked at the main menu and it's like one player, two player, and training. And that's it.
Where's my combat mode?
That's just weird. It's like, you know, and back then that was probably like, you know, that was probably pretty much par for the course. But man, it's just, it just seems so bare bones.
I think 1080 has some pretty cool track designs, but
yeah.
What I remember in terms of the controls, the tricks, I don't remember trying to do that many tricks in it except in like the half pipe mode or in the half pipe level at least. But what I remember the most is it is very difficult to land.
Yeah.
From any jump, it's really hard to land.
Ah! Yep. The Top Gun of snowboarding game.
Iceman, yes.
So my experience with this game extends to many play sessions that they had set up at Sears back when Sears used to sell video games, like had a section devoted to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, this is the worst game I've ever played because I constantly was face down. Like, okay, here we go. Oh,
it's very easy to fall over in that game.
I think I face planted like my entire way down the mountain.
For sure, it's a game that I remember the first time I played it, I really disliked it. But my friend and I had rented it together, I guess, or something. We had it for like a whole weekend.
You're already pot committed at that point. You're like, shit, we spent $4 at Blockbuster. I mean,
yeah. So we just played we just kept playing it, and eventually we actually got the hang of it. I think, John, it might be, I mean, I don't know how patient you are, but it might be worth trying a couple more times to see if it sticks more. Because
That's a bad statement, Johnny. We know how patient John is.
The game gets 5 minutes. 5 minutes, and it's out.
And that's if you could dedicate the time to unwrapping it.
You can. I mean, I know a lot of our listeners are thinking, man, I love 1080. And the thing is, if you really stick with it, it's very idiosyncratic, especially with the controls. But mm-hmm. if you get used to it, there's a lot of fun to be had in that game.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I figure, you know, it's a Nintendo-made game. I mean, there has to be something in there good. I still have faith.
There's got to be a nugget of
there has to be a nugget
stuff.
It definitely lacks the Miyamoto touch in terms of like intuitive controls and
yeah,
definitely lacks that.
Yeah, the one thing that the worst thing that sticks in my mind is when you're going down the hill and the background, it's just one big texture. It's just fucking terrible. It's just one big blurry, ugly texture. So you have like your kind of like your polygon models like on both sides of you for the hill. And everything in front of you is just one big blurry texture of like a lake, a snowy beach, and trees.
I'm surprised you can tell that's what that stuff is.
I think that's my interpretation of it. Might be a Rorschach. A Rorschach image, for all I know.
All right. Moving on. You know, obviously, the past couple of weeks, I played a hell of a lot of Metroid. And I also played a lot of Mother 3, which I'm still trying to finish. I'm extremely close to the end now. But it's just that game, every time I feel like I must be near the end, you know, it just kind of... So I got to Newport City, and anyway, I'm struggling to find time to finish that up, but I don't want to talk about it until then because I'm still planning to do the sort of special thing with Neil where we get all spoilerific on it. But those two have taken up a lot of my time, so everything else is sort of bits and pieces. I did finish Splinter Cell Conviction on 360. It's a pretty short game. I just blew through the single player and sent it back to Gamefly, but I did enjoy it quite a bit. I would I've tried Splinter Cell 1 or 2 back on GameCube, I think, you know, once they ported it, and didn't like it at all.
They're very slow games. It's like, slide across this pole for 6 minutes.
Yeah, you know, and...
What did you do?
Sometimes, yeah, that's how... I remember some of that stuff. I remember, like, monitoring my sound levels. Like, you couldn't walk too fast because you'd make too much noise, and you'd... it was like really hardcore trial and error stealth stuff.
You know,
like if you make one mistake, they see you and you're dead. Conviction is it feels a lot looser and more modern and more player friendly. You get seen all the time, and when you do, you shoot that guy in the face.
Yeah, he got Jack Bauer'd, basically.
I mean, it is very Jack Bauer. So I would describe this as kind of like Metal Gears of War. So
slick.
Yeah. Or actually, I know John
a disapproving
will.
Groan.
I know John and Greg will at least appreciate this. It reminds me a hell of a lot of the stealth stuff in Batman Arkham Asylum, except instead of swinging around on gargoyles, you're crawling behind boxes. But it feels very similar. Like you
sounds so much cooler.
Which is approximately the same thing.
It does. It feels like you're a predator and you're preying because you kill these dudes. Like you will. It's not like Metal Gear where you're a lot of times you're actually like you just want to get away from them. In Splinter Cell, you can kill every dude that you ever meet in the game, and you. In a lot
all
of cases,
of
you want to. Yeah, I mean, you kill lots of guys. But you don't just run in there guns and blazing.
Nathan
you
Drake
sneak
style?
Up behind them and then you kill them.
Oh, it's much more visceral than Nathan Drake.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's very action-y, but you have to use stealth in order to kill these guys. So that's why I say, you know, Metal Gears of War, it feels like a nice combination of the stealth elements of Metal Gear with the, you know, the sort of action feel and a lot of cover-based stuff. Sometimes you're using cover to dodge gunfire, and sometimes you're just using it to hide. So it's really cool, actually. I like the combination quite a bit, and it feels really well balanced between stealth and action and shooting. You know, it's not too much of either one. So I really enjoyed the game quite a bit. The story stuff is also done pretty well. The Michael Ironside performance is interesting, as you may have heard. He does sound kind of inebriated through a lot of it, or else he really needs to spit out of his tobacco chew.
But does he also sound like he's like 70 years old? Like isn't he getting up there in age to play a Jack Bauer type?
It doesn't fit with the character model very well, I would say, but otherwise, the story is, I mean, it's super absurd Tom Clancy stuff. I mean, suffice it to say, the last level takes place in the White House and you have to rescue the president.
Of course.
Like you know, it's that level of crazy Tom Clancy crap. But, you know, there's an EMP involved, of course, and it's all like this near future bullshit. But it's very entertaining. It's very 24. You know, if you like that kind of stuff, you'll get into it. But, yeah, I enjoyed that game quite a bit. I've been making my way sort of slowly through Secret of Monkey Island 2. I actually bought it like over a month ago, and I've played it just a little bit at a time. This is like the HD version that they put on Live Arcade, and I like the first Secret of Monkey Island, and I feel like I'm not enjoying this one as much. It's weird. I think it's actually more popular than the first one. But maybe it's just because to me it doesn't feel like it's any more advanced than the first one. I mean, it just feels like it's all the same stuff. There's, you know, some of the same characters and even not the same locations, but they feel the same. And if anything, the puzzles are actually just more obscure and annoying this time around. You know, even less logical. So, I don't know. I guess I'll probably finish it eventually because there's this hint system where if you just hammer on X long enough, eventually it will tell you how to solve the puzzle.
Hey, dumbass, get the coconut.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times I kind of don't care. So a lot of times I'll kind of take a stab at solving it. And if my first guess doesn't work, I'm like, fuck it. And I just hit the hint button because I just don't, you know, I just want to move on. Basically, the challenge of solving the puzzle is not very meaningful to me. So yeah, for some reason, I'm not as into it as I was the first time.
I'm surprised James isn't already gorging on Laytona.
Yeah. I just have too many games to burn through before
it's
I get to
it's not coming
that.
Out to, for like a month in Europe, so I choose to take it as a purposeful slight on me not being able to play it that you
No, it's just that I have 5 games stacked up I want to burn through before I put a 6th one on the stack.
Are they all Tails games? I'm at 60%.
No, I'm out of them. I'm out of Tails games.
James, embrace it, buddy. Embrace it. Keep that backlog coming, buddy.
So the last thing I'll mention is I finally beat the campaign in StarCraft 2. And it's awesome. That game is really cool. I haven't tried multi yet. I'm a little scared to, but I'm going through some of the challenges which are supposed to sort of prepare you, you know, give you some of the basics of what it's like to play online and what it's like to use the other races.
That should still have been in the game.
There are to some extent. You don't get to play as the Zerg in the campaign, but you do get to play like 5 missions as the Protoss, and it's nice. It's a nice change of pace. But you will not hear me complain about the length or the depth of the Terran campaign. It's really impressive. It is way better than the first StarCraft. The missions are just beautifully designed, and there's a lot of them. I mean, that is like a 20-hour campaign. I was surprised, really surprised at how long it took to play through. So you can tell that they put a ton of effort and a ton of money into making that. And, you know, the Terrans are the least interesting of the three races to me anyway. But seeing how much I enjoyed playing as the Terrans, I'm really excited to see the Zerg and the Protoss get that same treatment. And I am more than happy to pay for those. I mean, when they first announced this, I think they didn't really communicate it very well. But once you play the game, you will not be complaining about that anymore. And, yeah. You know, I'm happy with it, and I haven't even touched the multiplayer, which is the main reason for that game to exist in the first place. So it's that's really impressive stuff. And, you know, I'll probably jump into multi and get my ass kicked and wait until the next one comes out.
But now, how does that work, though? Do they have, like, any matchmaking?
Yes, very. I mean, it's probably the most progressive matchmaking of any game I've ever heard of, because you go in it.
So basically, Johnny's not allowed to play anybody from Korea.
No, you're not. Matchmaking. They're not allowing cross region. They said they might open that up later.
but they'll all be in a tier that we're not allowed to play with. So it's okay.
Well, yeah. You'd probably have to be like on a certain tier in order to do that. Yeah.
Easy, normal, hard, super hard, and Korean. That's what it's going to be.
Yeah. No, yeah, really, basically. I think the way they do it is when you first jump in there, and I haven't done this yet, but what happens is you go into multi and you play like 5 placement rounds. And they just assign you against random ass people. It could be anybody. You could be matched up against the best player in the world or the worst player in the world. But they try to get like a variety, and they see how you do, and they collect a lot of statistics, and then they put you into, they sort of rank you based on how you did in those 5 games. And then over time, even after that, it moves you up or down based on how well you do, and it's supposedly you kind of reach this asymptote where it evens out, and apparently over time you're supposed to average out to about a 50% ratio. So they want to get it, they fine-tuned it so that you should always feel like you're playing someone at exactly the right skill level for you. Like, I could beat this guy or I could lose to this guy. It comes down to how much am I on my game today. And that's exciting. I mean, if that actually works, that's how every game should be, right?
Yeah.
So your first few games, you're likely to be either bored or
Yeah, you could
blasted.
Get totally smoked at first. But they try to make that very clear up front. We are randomly matching you. And then after that, it's supposed to get dramatically better and better and better as you keep playing.
So the original StarCraft actually did have a restriction in there, because you could press the space bar a bunch of times and hit enter and cause everybody playing the Korean client to crash.
What?
You could. Yeah.
I'm sure they fixed that.
They patched it eventually, but it was fun in every game to go space, enter and see if anybody crashed. Like, oh, somebody dropped. I got him.
Yeah, I never really played the original randomly very much. I remember playing some games with Evan Birchfield against the computer, and that was pretty fun. And people still like to do that. Well, I forget what they call it, but you just kind of team up with another human against the AI.
That was how I actually like to play that game, because
you can still do that in StarCraft 2.
Well, you'd have to, or the game would be a failure. It's fun to just go out there and basically say, all right, we're going to put an AI and we're going to set the skill level and see what we can take.
Yeah, it was like what people used to do in Perfect Dark, you know?
Yeah,
like
what I used to do specifically. I know I've heard this somewhere before.
Yeah, so it was kind of fun to just throw yourself against what might be the pinnacle of AI in that game.
And you can learn a lot that way, too.
It's like, oh, good, he nuked both of us at once. Thank you, game.
Yeah, well, people are probably sick of hearing about StarCraft 2, but I'm still playing it, and I think it's really, really good. Greg, take us out, please.
A quiet week in the aftermath of Other M. Portable-wise, I've actually started a new game plus a Chrono Trigger.
So nice.
Nice.
Take that, John.
I'm years away. But one day.
Starting?
I'm I'm at least 5,000 hours away from where you are right now.
I don't know if I'll live to see that happen, but if I do, I'll probably be a brain in a jar.
Chrono Trigger's not even, it's not even that long of a game.
That's the joke.
Yeah.
It's long
New Game
enough.
Plus, though, can be really interesting experience, especially if it's literally your second time playing, because a lot of times when people play it the first time, they won't know how to do everything. You know, they won't be able to do all, unless you use a guide or something.
Right.
It's likely that you'll miss quite a few things. And so going through New Game Plus, not only do you get to see your characters become, like, ridiculously powerful, but it actually gives you access to a lot of things that you either couldn't or wouldn't have gotten the first time.
Well, yeah. and you can do the, can't you do the job ending that way and just be like, I'm going to go cut straight to the end. Let's do this shit.
Yeah, but actually, it's very difficult to beat Lavos if you go straight into it on your very first New Game Plus. I would recommend playing all the way through New Game Plus and then starting yet another
New Game Plus.
And then you can try to fight Lavos right off the bat.
I did fight him right off the bat one time. Like, that is the shortest RPG in history.
Yeah, you can beat it in about 30 minutes if you...
I was like, done!
Get to the end.
Although, it's quite difficult. It's really quite difficult.
No, it wasn't easy, but it was funny. I was like, yes!
I want to say there's one way you can do it in which you don't even have Luca yet. So it's only Chrono and Marl, and that is really pretty difficult to do.
You'd probably have to be max leveled. I mean...
Yeah, so you have to have the star stats. And it's the nice thing about going through New Game Plus is you collect all the magic tabs and life tabs and things like that. And so, you know, your characters get, like, dramatically more powerful a second time through.
You become like God.
Sorry, I could do... a whole podcast about Chrono Trigger, like a whole weekly podcast about Chrono Trigger.
Weekly.
Yes.
Because it was going to replace Retronauts, Chrononauts every week.
I'd be down.
No, it was my first time doing New Game Plus. Didn't do it back in the 90s. So I just probably just chip away on various train rides over the next year and a half, but it'll still be quicker than John's glacial approach to finishing games.
No respect.
Greg, that's not true. The glaciers are retreating relatively quickly now.
Yeah. I meant their usual movement rather than their exceptional disappearance.
Yuck it up, boys.
The new stuff I've been playing, first of all, is a couple of demos. This is shocking stuff. Japanese Nintendo demos.
Get out of here.
What?
It's crazy Japanese. What are they thinking?
I did play the Vanquish demo as well.
It was a mistake. They accidentally released.
Greg, real quick, what did you think of the Vanquish demo?
It was a bit much.
So
They were just like waggling its Japanese silliness in my face.
It is really over the top. I loved it. I thought it was really cool
now,
and fun.
This is done by Shinji Mikami, right?
Yeah, and Platinum.
Okay.
It's a Platinum game.
I just want to validate what I've immediately thought of that game when I saw all the videos of it. I'm thinking it's PN03. Am I pretty close?
It is much more modern and sophisticated than PN03, but it does have the same kind of speed and flash.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean by it. I was like, this looks like PN03. Oh, God.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of PN03, but without the butt and applied to, like... applied to a cover-based third-person shooter.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it is super Japanese and, like, very... high contrast, you know, like a lot of white, shiny metal structures, and it moves really fast. I mean, you like your dude has jetpacks, so you like slide around the level.
Yeah, like sort of like some sort of mech version of a base runner in baseball. I mean,
yeah,
coming at home plate, just like decimating the catch. But it's not my kind of game off the bat, but. I don't know whether it's a bit too much for me. It does seem really, really crazy, really, really Japanese.
It's
and
very
also
Japanese.
Borrows a quip from the Roland Emmerich Godzilla. Bad idea.
Nice.
Which one?
Which, for the record, is we're going to need bigger guns.
Oh, okay.
In a quote-unquote homage to Jaws. Which I'm sure the big shark would be terribly offended by.
I saw that Godzilla on opening day, and I had my friend and I went to go see it, and his mom drove us about 50 miles to go see that.
It's like it's got the guy out of Leon in it. It can't be that bad. It was.
It was really bad.
So the Nintendo demos, first of all, Okami Den is up on the Nintendo channel in Japan as a downloadable demo because it's coming out pretty soon. I think it's the end of this month in Japan, which is kind of, it's kind of interesting they're taking so long to bring it over because it's a 2011 game.
Yeah, like Ghost Trick. Thank you. Thank you, Capcom.
That part of the year is going to be so crowded with everything that's coming out on all the platforms, and then the looming threat of 3DS. I really worry. Even, I mean, Okami, the franchise is not a commercial juggernaut as it is, but
no, it needed this game to be successful. Basically,
it seems like it's going to get more overlooked than even it might otherwise have
been. It's going to
get
annihilated, let's be honest.
Yes. Mm. I think Capcom still has, Capcom USA in particular, has no idea what to do with these games. I mean, I guess I should be grateful that Okami Den is coming out in America at all, but I feel like maybe the reason that they've delayed it to 2011 is they just can't be bothered to spend the localization resources on it when they've got all these other games coming out in the fall.
Capcom USA feels like if I could just get in there and do stuff for a company for like 1 month and just change their priorities, that is the company that I could fix the easiest. Because that company has no clue what the hell is going
James
on.
James Messiah Complex.
Even when you spoke to them at E3, you're like, damn, they have no idea what's going on. You're like, hey, when's Okami Den coming out? Oh, we don't know yet. I'm like, but I know the release date. Why don't you know it?
Yeah, so it's imminent in Japan. I did get to play this bit of the E3 London event as well, although it was a bit screwed up because someone had been playing the demo before. Chibiterasu had been separated from the little kid.
Yes.
So I had to like spend ages just finding the kid before I could do anything in that
demo. Is it the same demo as that one?
No, it wasn't, as far as I was aware. Like I said, because that was sort of mid-demo, so I don't know what preceded it. But with this one, it was very basic. It was pretty much just like you're going through the kind of, you know, the bit at the start of Okami where you're in that kind of abstract sort of blackness and you're learning how to do everything. It's precisely analogous thing for the DS game. So it wasn't very exciting. It's just demonstrating the basics of it. So not a lot to say about it other than even in that very basic part, I just continue to be very impressed by the graphics. I mean, if you track these graphics back to the sort of dawn of the DS, it's pretty amazing.
What they're
managing to squeeze out of it 6 years hence. And the stuff with drawing a path for your little helper character and solving puzzles that way has the potential to be really cool. You know, I love what they did in Spirit Tracks with that kind of stuff. So, you know, I'm kind of all in favor of that. But yeah, the switching issue, bringing down the canvas for the celestial brushes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the lag, the time lapse that occurs there is a concern, but I guess you're just going to have to see how much it's leveraged in combat and in the puzzle designs to really make a final kind of assessment on that. And, I mean, I think in Okami, there was a little bit too much combat for me. I didn't really like it that much. And there was times where it felt like there was kind of shoehorning a bit much of it in, maybe to pad it out or whatever. And certainly with like the D-pad and the more limited interface of DS, I hope they kind of scale that back and don't feel so under pressure, because it is a handheld game. So there's no need to go crazy.
But do you think they could have improved the combat?
Well, they could have done. I mean, but I think the problem is that the most obvious way to improve it with the DS is to make better use of the stylus. But of course, if that's going to involve a lot of switching, that could be problematic because, again, bogging it down with a lot of those time lapses. So, yeah, I'm not sure about that yet.
I was going to ask because the E3 demo had very little combat in it.
Right, yeah. Well, this was just two enemies at the end. That was the close of the demo here. They sort of demonstrated all the puzzle stuff using the celestial brush, and then the final part was just a couple of little enemies. Nothing but so.
The Japanese tend to think that a tutorial makes for a good demo, and I strongly
disagree.
Apparently
they do, with my experience of these things. Although, I mean, Ghost Trick was better as a demo on the Nintendo channel.
Yeah, that is a pretty good demo. It's a tutorial, but it feels like part of the main game.
Well, cause
yeah,
it is
because
part
you
of the
are
main
solving
game.
Puzzles. I mean, right. And, yeah, I'm sure it is part of the main game. So, yeah, I mean, that was better, definitely. But the other demo I've been playing, this is a real one from left field. It was a new WiiWare game, I think a couple of weeks ago at this point, in Japan, published by Nintendo, called Through Space High Velocity 3D Puzzle. And it's been rated, I think, in either in Europe or Australia, or so you can kind of assume this is going to be not too far away in the Western territories. But the real kicker of it is that there was the game going up on the Nintendo WiiWare channel in Japan at the same time as a demo for said game going up as well.
A WiiWare demo.
A WiiWare demo existing at all, but not just that, it was actually day and date with the game being available. So very, very odd development. And so almost that alone persuaded me to partake and to download the demo.
The sheer novelty of it.
Exactly. You can't look that kind of gift horse in the mouth. So I downloaded it, and it can be described as Tetris meets Muscle March.
Which the world needs more
but
Tetris.
That's a kind of a weird way to describe it, Greg, because Muscle March is kind of based on the Human Tetris.
Human Tetris.
A Japanese game show. I forget what it was called in America when they brought it over.
It was called Hole in the Wall.
Hole in the Wall, right.
It's Hole in the Wall, but instead of with, you know, oiled up bizarre muscle men and or pandas or whatever the hell was on that
game. It was a polar bear.
Polar bear. It is just these sort of Tetramino style shapes.
So it's not as good as what you're telling us.
Basically. Yeah, well, I have not played Muscle March, remember. I was spared that.
Up my most wanted list? Down my most wanted list.
But so the demo just kind of takes you through a sort of tutorial kind of section, and then after that you get to play, you know, what would seem to be kind of what would be the main game. So what you're doing is you've got these Tetramino like 3D blocks, you can rotate them along all the axes, you know, all the three in 90 degree increments, and then you're trying to fit them into these various different holes. But not all of the holes are actually totally restrictive. You know, you could actually fit them in multiple ways. But what they'll do is have like certain parts highlighted, and those, if you can actually touch those points, you know, if you configure the shape in the correct way to touch those points, you'll get more points onto your score. And then if you could kind of complete it quicker, because you have like a sort of limited amount of control over how quickly this shape travels towards this succession of walls with holes in them, you could kind of put your foot on the gas, basically, if you've got it set up right, then just back, you know, so it's rewarding you for quickly orienting it correctly. The only problem I kind of had with it just in the demo was that the kind of methods for rotating it along the different axes wasn't all that intuitive, because it is just like different buttons. So it's kind of sometimes you're like, which button, you know, when you're first playing it, you know, you just get used to it. It's like, oh, which button rotates it that way again? So I don't know whether there'll be like different control schemes possibly with because it's Japanese demo. I'm, you know, kind of a bit at sea trying to figure it out for myself. But, you know, maybe like they could have a classic controller set up and, you know, it'd be easier to kind of separate out the different kind of twisting or whatever in that kind of interface. But it seems like it could be fun. I mean, it's like 800 points in Japan. I mean, I'm not sure. There are some differences that happen with pricing between the two regions, like with Muscle March, for instance, I think was 800 and then 500. Or weirdly, Bit Trip Runner was reduced to 500 when it just came out in Japan.
Wow. Good deal. That's a very good deal.
Yeah, I got jobbed. If only I'd waited. Couldn't hold out.
Then you might not have understood the story, Greg, if you'd...
Yeah, I know. All the text. The rising value of the yen continues to make virtual console and WiiWare purchases from Japan more expensive.
Yes.
All the time.
So do you think you might buy it when it comes out in Europe?
I'd consider it. I'll read like full reviews. You know, on the basis of this, you think it's just like a high school game? Which I could get into those kinds of things potentially, but you know, you want still a certain breadth of modes and a certain depth of gameplay that just on the basis of this demo, it's difficult for me to say that it's going to have it. So yeah, but interesting, but very much in the wait and see category.
Alrighty, well, a WiiWare demo from Japan. That's a pretty interesting way to close out the segment. So that's our new business. Now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we have your listener mail, and we're going to talk about our most anticipated games of the fall. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, this week we've got extensive coverage of the Tokyo Game Show. It's happening in Japan right now. We're not there. But you know who is? Matt Walker and James Charlton, our two intrepid Japanese correspondents, or Japan correspondents, neither is Japanese. But anyway, they read and speak Japanese, and that makes them perfect for covering all the awesome new games. We've got impressions of Miles Edgeworth 2, Ni no Kuni.
Yeah, and there's absolutely no Wii stuff, because there are 10 Wii games at all of TGS.
Wow.
All right, and on the review front, we have Zach giving us a review of Gunblade NY and LA Machine Guns Arcade Hits Pack, probably the most unnecessarily long title in history for a game.
Well, at least they abbreviated the location, though.
I know, yes. That's the least they could do. Okay, yeah, he gives his review of the arcade game Double Pack. Has it aged well, or should you leave it in the past? Read his thoughts and find out.
I love those games in the arcade.
We also have impressions of Kirby's Epic Yarn. Aaron has some hands-on time with the new Kirby title and discusses its difficulty, and also describes its music, which I specifically asked about, and what players will be able to unlock. There's a whole bunch of collectible stuff in there.
Yes, there's also some very nice videos in there.
Yeah, tons of videos.
All right, we have a blog from Pedro on why storytelling matters in video games, where he explains that it's not the story, but it's how you tell it that really counts. And he compares Arkrise Fantasia's amazing failure at storytelling to games like Final Fantasy X.
Also kind of a failure.
No, trust me. By comparison, Arkrise Fantasia fails, and he explains why. But I'll give you the short answer. The voice acting is terrible. We also have reviews for... Seriously, John? Really? This game? Okay, we have reviews for 24/7 Solitaire, which is DSiWare, where Matt Blunden looks at this game and tells us whether or not it's the definitive handheld version of Solitaire. By the way...
It would not be.
Because our readers need to know, James.
I think every version of Solitaire is the definitive version of Solitaire.
Next, we have Neil railing against the pathetic state of Nintendo's weekly downloads in This Week in Awful Downloads, and presenting some interesting theories on why it's plummeted this far.
The TSI was always this far.
And in features, we have the ongoing Flips Twisted World Developer Diary. So this week, Frozen North programmer Andrew Wolosian tells us about the limitations of the Wii hardware and how their coding team worked around these limitations to create the game they wanted to deliver.
I agree with Neil, who said that the Flips Twisted World Developer Diary is the best thing on our site that no one reads. You can change that. Go read it. It's really, really interesting stuff. All right, that's the latest content on NintendoWorldReport.com, so check it out every day. It's the fall, y'all, and that means there's a lot of games coming out, and we're going to talk about the ones we care about the most right now. James, you're up first. Tell us about the Nintendo platform games that you are most interested in. We're going to go through the end of 2010.
Yes, which was fine up until about 6 hours ago when Ghost Trick got pushed into to 2011.
Yeah, that's bad news. So Ghost Trick got pushed back. Last week, Conduit 2 got pushed back into 2011. That would have probably been one of mine out of sheer curiosity.
Would have been on my list for sure.
There's a few other ones recently, fairly high-profile things that
have
been...
Well, in Europe, Duck Hunt Country is 2011, right?
No, it's Kirby. It's Kirby. This.
Oh, okay. Oh, ew.
No.
So, James?
Yes.
What are you excited about and why?
So I'm going to pass on the Wii titles because I know that people are going to touch on them, so I'll let those sit for a while. I'm really interested in Final Fantasy IV Heroes of the Light, or Four Hats. I like what I saw at E3, even if it was at the most unpleasant booth in the world.
Oh, it was, yeah.
It was so loud. I don't understand.
It's just like Mafia 2 videos drowning everything out.
No, but that was Square's booth, though. They were just like, all right, we're going to pump up the volume for the Four Heroes trailer so loud that you can't hear Four Heroes with noise-canceling headphones on.
E3 is such a terrible place to play an RPG like that.
Yeah, but that booth was the worst. I mean,
yeah,
it was
really
the
bad.
Loudest thing I've ever... I've stood near jet engines, and it was about as loud.
I felt like they were playing the Brown Note or something. I was just really uncomfortable standing there playing it.
It was terrible, but I still enjoyed playing that demo, so I figured, okay, if I could enjoy it under those circumstances, I'm going to love the shit out of this game.
Yeah.
But basically, I like the style of it, so there's not a class system, but there are hats, essentially, that you can equip that act like a quasi-class system, and you can
level basically up. The job system.
Yeah, it's basically. Just, it's a little bit, not quite as structured, I think. Mm-hmm. And you can move between things more easily. So it's an interesting mechanic. I like to try it out. It looks good. It played pretty well from the demo. The demo wasn't real expansive.
It has a weird little battle system, doesn't it?
It does. It's kind of strange.
I think I like it.
Yeah, I mean, from what I played, I enjoyed it, but I only got to fight a couple battles before my head felt like it was going to be compressed.
Brain turned to jello.
The other DS game I'm really looking forward to, obviously I've talked about it 100,000 times, is Golden Sun Dark Dawn. It's Golden Sun. That's pretty much the extent of the reasons I'm excited for it.
I kind of hope it's not Golden Sun.
every video I've seen indicates it's Golden Sun.
Yeah.
I got a little bit of playtime with this at the E3 London stuff. Obviously, I'm not a big RPG guy. I never played any of the Golden Suns. But the one thing that kind of intrigues me about it relative to other RPGs on DS, of which there are many, is that there seems to be more kind of environmental puzzle solving and stuff. Is that a big part of the series?
Yes.
Yes. That's the best part of the series.
Yeah, it sounds cool to me.
You use the skill, the magical skills you accumulate to move shit or clear gaps and stuff like that.
What concerns me is the battle system. I think the last thing I heard about Dark Dawn is there's something like several dozen genii that they're putting in there, and the gen system was so broken in the first game.
What do you mean by it was broken?
Fucking broken.
It wasn't just broken.
Well, what was broken about it?
Read my review.
Oh.
Seriously, it's like you can win every single battle by just using your gen. It is a win button.
They were too powerful, but at the same time, I enjoyed mixing them to try to make different classes. So if you certain mixes of gen on a character would turn them into different classes and give
you
different
powers. I don't think that's in the first one. I don't remember that.
I think it is. I know it's in the second one. I remember you can transfer all your gen over to the second one, and that really gave you the ability to turn yourself into God, because you would collect all of them from the first game and then combine them with all of them from the second game. And the final boss was just like, oh shit, I'm gonna die.
Yeah, and I guess there's kind of been some hints that you might actually be able to transfer stuff from the GBA games to the new one for DS as well.
If you don't have a DSi.
Right, yeah. I think
well,
you can...
they had codes.
Yeah, the codes. They did have codes before.
Oh, I remember the codes. I had to enter my code by hand because I couldn't get somebody to lend me their GBA for 30 seconds. And the code is like 800 characters long. It's terrible.
Right. It's like a Metroid password.
Oh, it's like the Bible converted to hexadecimal. It's
have you guys ever seen a Bomberman password for NES?
Yes.
Oh, boy. Those are some fucking passwords.
It's terrible.
My mom actually beat Bomberman for NES. She's like an idiot savant with that game. I mean, she like barely plays video games. That's like the one, you know?
Nice.
I remember she was there was a period where she was like a stay-at-home mom for a very brief period, and she was renting... We originally rented it, my sister and I, for ourselves, and she got into it. She started renting, like re-renting it for herself.
Just buy it.
She was like playing it all day. We get home and she's still playing it. And she had this notebook, and the password would stretch from one side of the page to the other. It was like this giant, it's like a 50 character string unbroken all the way across the screen.
That's
unbelievable.
Like, that's Golden Sun passwords best. Because I remember I wrote it down wrong. I had one character wrong. I had a 7 that was a 1. And I had to go back, and it didn't work. I had to go back and check every fucking character until I found the one I messed up. And it was like the third to last. I was like, ah, damn it!
Yeah, I think if they rebalance the combat in the new Golden Sun, it could be a really fun game.
It looks nice. There's some weird aliasing stuff going on, but I guess it's okay. It's a DS game. Mm-hmm. But it's still, I mean, it looked nice at E3. It seemed to control pretty well, so I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah, the problem for that game is that it's coming out in the same year as Dragon Quest IX and the new Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
So it just there are other RPGs on the DS that look a lot better is the problem.
It's a tough space to be living in right now.
Yes. All right, John, what about you?
Let's see. I am looking at, well, Kirby, of course. I mean, some of the games I have, I mean, Kirby, I think a lot of us are looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Just kind of, you know, really interesting. It's kind of a throwback to some of the Yoshi's games of times past.
Yeah, the vehicle transformations is kind of looks like it's going to be like almost Yoshi's Island-ish, so there's going to be a lot of them and... Mm-hmm. Some quite interesting different gameplay styles. Like, and on IGN, Craig Harris was talking about the fact you like a train at one point and you draw the tracks with the pointer, almost like Canvas Curse style. So it's just cool to hear that they're injecting some kind of fresh elements into it that way.
That's cool.
I mean, it just looks like a really fun game to play through. You know, I'm not expecting some, you know, super hardcore experience from it. Obviously, it's a Kirby game, but I mean, even compared
probably
to...
be a good one to play with your wife.
Yeah.
Well, I think, as far as we can tell, you can't die.
No, that's confirmed. You can't.
So yeah. it would be a good game to play with kids, too, if you have them.
But supposedly, you know, there is going to be a certain amount of challenge in there from the point of view of finding all the beads and like unlocking secret levels. And if it follows the Wario Land Shake It playbook, which there's kind of been some suggestion that it will in this area, the secret levels may well be significantly more tricky. Yep. Than the normal ones.
Yeah. Yes.
And I would be very, very pleased with that. And again, it sounds very similar, like you've got three like kind of treasures to find, except now they're like little patches that you take back to the sort of hub world and stuff. So it sounds like it's going to be quite a successor to Wario Land in a way.
Yeah. And I think it'll be an enchanting experience to play through. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. You know, definitely love the art style, of course. Let's see. Other stuff I'm looking forward to, NBA Jam. Always a big fan of the NBA Jam series, and you know, I think the Wii is, you know, perfect for those kinds of sports games where they're just crazy, kind of going back to, you know, wanting a version of SSX. The reason why I was so surprised is, why wouldn't a game like that be on the Wii? It just seems like, you know, the perfect kind of console for it. So really looking forward to just the NBA Jam gameplay. I mean, to be honest, I haven't really kept up with it too much, but I don't really feel like I have to because it's freaking NBA Jam. I mean,
so are you aware of the HD console kind of situation with that game?
Yeah, with the sort of the downloadable version.
They're giving away...
You've got the proper NBA game, you get to
right,
download
right.
it.
Yeah, I guess right. It comes with a code, probably.
Yeah.
But, John, are you planning to pay for the Wii version, then?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would like to get the Wii version, specifically just because, you know, I think it'd be a really fun game to play with Wii controls.
It looks... fun.
I've heard good things about the motion.
I only played it for a few minutes at E3, and I was able to basically nail threes from wherever the hell I wanted. So
yeah.
I was like, hey, I'm going to shoot this three from the other basket. Hey, I made it!
Well, I'm not really looking to it for you know, some sort of basketball simulator at all. Really, I want it to be completely crazy.
And it was. Yeah. It was batshit crazy.
That's the other stuff I'm looking forward to. On the WiiWare front, I'm looking forward to Retro City Rampage, which looks like a completely crazy mashup of about, you know, 10 different classic NES games into one sort of old school Grand Theft Auto, toss them all in a pot, and, you know, there's a little bit of Commando, a little bit of Bionic Commando, you know, a little bit of TMNT. Really crazy if you haven't seen it. I mean, it's...
So is it kind of like Retro Game Challenge, but all the games are mixed together?
No, it's, well, the thing is, it takes place in a city, and obviously you are, you know, you're kind of fighting crime. It's all very tongue in cheek, but you're like a little character on the screen, a little gun toting badass guy. But it's just, there's all kinds of things. Check out the trailer on YouTube, and it's really crazy. There's so many different styles of games. Like there's like one area where your character's, you know, swimming, and it looks like something out of, you know, Super Mario Brothers, where the first underwater area looks exactly like it. There's, you know, you can crash through stuff with your car like in the old Grand Theft Autos. So that looks really cool.
I will have to check that out.
Yeah, also Bonk Brink of Extinction. Not too sure. As far as I know, I think it's coming out this year, as far as I know.
It feels like it's been in development forever.
Yeah, it's...
I think they just announced it really early.
Yeah,
maybe. I mean, there was talk recently that they had conceived of it as being a retail game or something. And then they went
bad
out,
idea.
but even when they announced it long ago, it was as a downloadable game.
Yes.
So it's still kind of surprising that we're still waiting for this one.
Currently, the release date is simply 2010.
Yeah, and who knows, you know, maybe it'll pull a ghost trick on us. I'm not really too sure.
Well, especially if we're dealing with, I mean, WiiWare dates, I mean, they're ephemeral.
Well, I wonder... I wonder what's going to happen, though, because that game's coming out on all three downloadable platforms.
Yeah, it's quite a rare thing for all the versions, PS3 and
I wonder if they'll give Hudson more leeway when they go to release it on the virtual the WiiWare. Be like, well, look, this is the day we want to release on.
It's weird. I mean, if you look at Mega Man 9 and 10, they actually released like a week early on WiiWare.
On Nintendo,
and then they came to Xbox and
I think, though, that was kind of like an homage.
I have a very limited history with Bonk, but it's a Mario or Sonic style too. It's more like Mario than
with your
Sonic,
forehead.
But
mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. I enjoyed what I've played of it. So I'm kind of curious. I don't even know if I've seen. I mean, I watched that teaser trailer that they put out, but that had no gameplay in it. So yeah. I don't even know if I know what it looks like.
It looks like Bonk.
Yeah. It's a straight up platformer. I was a big fan of the Bonk series back in the day, so it's good to see it revived.
Back in the day when it was based on the current environment, basically.
when it was based on John Lindemann.
Contemporary.
He's kind of your he's like your alter ego.
John, what's it like to hit pterodactyls with your forehead? Just out of curiosity.
It's awesome.
Okay.
What's it like to eat a big piece of meat and turn into a lizard version of yourself?
It never gets old, let me tell you. And it's a hit at parties.
Yeah, I bet. Okay. My most anticipated games, they're coming to Nintendo platforms. I have to start with Rock Band 3. I am really, 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 really excited for Rock Band 3. The more I hear about it, the more I want it now. And, I've recently been even going back and playing some Rock Band 2 because my achievements on that game are still pathetic. It's so hard to get achievements on that game. But I haven't played much Rock Band at parties lately. We kind of played a good bit of it when it first came out. But I think with the novelty of the keyboard controller and some of the new stuff that they're doing, it's going to be one of those things that people are going to want to come over and check out. And moreover, I think, especially because I've said before, but I own a real keyboard, and so I'm going to get that MIDI adapter and just plug it in. And so I'm really excited at the prospect of actually maybe learning to play some stuff on keyboard while enjoying the game itself as well. That's exciting. And down the road, I would love to get that Fender guitar, the real guitar that they're making for it, but they still haven't announced a price, and I'm a little concerned about
it. It's going to be high.
I might have to wait until that thing crashes and burns before I can pick it up, you know?
Yep.
My mind kind of melted watching that thing being demoed at E3. I would love to try it for myself. It's just, it's going to be so expensive. I don't know when I'm going to get a chance, but.
Remember the Rock Band, what was it, the stage effects kit?
Yeah. Lights and fog, right?
Oh, also, it's funny because I saw that on, somebody didn't believe me that it existed, and I pulled it up on
I don't blame them.
I pulled it up on GameStop on their website, and it has the review from IGN at the bottom. It says, "This is a worthy value at $90." And the price was the listed price for the actual object on GameStop was $20.
Yeah.
Like, what are they going to do for Rock Band 4, though? Because at this point, I mean, are they just going to have drums that explode and pyrotechnics every time you hit them?
No, that, you know, harmonica.
Are they going to have gospel choirs come out of the floor as Tony Hawk comes off of a ramp that descends from the ceiling?
Actually, it would be awesome if they could do some kind of horn. I think saxophone is probably the most natural way to go there. But that would be amazing if they made like a plastic saxophone that you could play in the game. I think it would be pretty fucking rad.
You couldn't use it at parties because you'd get sick from having to blow on the horn that other people
look,
have blown
that's,
on.
Yeah, that's probably 2 years
they could
away.
Have like a They could have a pack for theme songs from 80s TV shows.
Yeah. I think there's enough rock songs with saxophone. That
this week, the Michael Bolton pack.
Oh, excuse me while I hurl myself off a building.
Oh god. Soul survivor. Okay. So yeah, Rock Band 3 I'm super pumped about, and that's like about a month away. Next game is Bit Trip Fate, which is the fifth Empire Strikes Back, as they keep saying, it's the fifth entry in the Bit Trip series, and I've been a fan of the series from the start, but after what they did with Runner, I am way more enthusiastic about Bit Trip than
aroused.
I was a year ago. Aroused might indeed be the word. Bit Trip Runner is amazing. You know, I was really just blown away by how obsessed I got with that game. So, Fate, it's like a light gun game, except you're moving. There's a path on the screen, and sometimes it's kind of a straight line. Sometimes it looks like a roller coaster track sometimes.
Sine wave or...
Yeah, yeah. It goes into weird patterns, and you and basically you just push left and right on the joystick to move the character back and forth. So you have to dodge shots. It's a little bit like that... What was it, the fireworks game, Greg, for DS that you...
That was kind of like the Geometry Wars type thing, wasn't it? Big Bang Mini.
Big Bang Mini, yeah. It looks a little bit like that. The movement's very restricted because you're on this track, but you can still, you know, you move him left and right along the track to dodge shots.
I thought of it like Vid Ribbon with, like, shooting.
I'm not as familiar with Vib Ribbon, I guess. I thought that
That's where you put the CD in.
Oh, I know, but I think the gameplay of Vib Ribbon is more like a platformer, isn't it?
No, it's just a track. Well, kind of. It's basically just
more like Bit Trip Runner.
It's like a straight line you basically go across.
With it, I mean, look, it's weird because you're playing like kind of like a side-scrolling shoot-em-up with the pointer to target rather than just the usual sort of thing. But Commander Video, you can't just dodge anywhere or whatever. You dodge along a line.
Yeah, it seems like brain-melting.
So, you could describe it as an on-rails 2D shooter.
It is literally on rails. Like, he is on a rail that you can see. Yeah.
It looks interesting, certainly. Obviously, I like scrolling shooters, and this is going to be kind of one of those situations where they kind of subvert the conventions a little bit. I'm quite intrigued as to how that's going to turn out.
It looks very unusual. And, you know, it still has the weird psychedelic visuals and the sort of techno music and all that. So, not techno, more electronica is probably the better word. Yeah. But, I'm really intrigued by it, and I still hope they go with like some kind of weird rhythm-based RPG for the sixth game. That's what I told Alex Noisy that at E3, and he's like, I don't know if you could do an RPG with the pace of our games. I said, Half Minute Hero, you can do it.
Yep, absolutely.
And he said, what do you know about games? Fuck off.
Let me tell you how to do your job. That's all my developer interviews where I just go in and like, you know, say, hey, you should make this. It's always a good start to a question.
That's why Johnny has to sneak into the Nintendo roundtables.
So the next game on my list is GoldenEye. I enjoyed the multiplayer from what I played. It's still, even after Neil went out to play it, at the Activision event, he still didn't really get to try the single player. He played the tank level, but the actual single player where you're running around shooting and being stealthy, they still haven't let anybody play it.
That's
so
really
weird.
Troubling, I have to say.
It is, but I will say the hands-off demo that I saw at E3 was really impressive. So I don't know why they're not letting people play it yet.
Pre-render.
Maybe they're just in crunch mode and the development team couldn't be bothered to make a single player hands-on demo. I don't know. But it does look really, really, really cool. And I think they've got a lot of good ideas. And it's not one of those games where like I just know it's going to be awesome. It's not like Rock Band 3, which I know will be awesome. GoldenEye could be a total disaster, but I'm very, very interested by it. I'm fascinated by it because, you know, I think it's a weird thing. It's a Wii exclusive, which is kind of bold on their part.
Yeah.
And it does look pretty impressive, in my opinion.
It's kind of interesting because, I mean, for me, to the extent my interest in GoldenEye is mostly, you know, and some of this is because of my attitude towards first-person shooters in general. It's mostly the local multiplayer experience. You know, if the local multiplayer is really a lot of fun, I could see that picking up and trying to sort of spruce up the usual rads and boom blocks and brawl. But like, for you, presumably that wouldn't really be part of the package from what you've said before.
No, I rarely have people come over and play local games. So, but it does have online as well.
Yeah.
Which is nice to hear. And the really interesting thing is that the local multiplayer and the online multiplayer are separate modes.
Yeah.
They're like different levels. In the online, you rack up experience like in Call of Duty, you know, like in Modern Warfare. So it's really very different. It sounds like it's the total package, you know. It doesn't support Wii Speak, which is, you know, not that I like Wii Speak, but come on.
Yeah,
it really should, but it does seem like a really impressive package, and I'm very interested to see how good it turns out to be. Lastly, Flip's Twisted World, and I would not give a shit about this game if I hadn't been reading the developer diaries. not to be overly self-promotional. Well, it's not self-promotional. I don't have anything to do with those things anyway. I just read them. But I am really fascinated by everything I've read about the process of making it. And it, I think I'm as interested in the process as I am the game, but the game itself does seem really interesting. So it's like this weird like 3D spatial reasoning puzzle logic game, and you know that's I like that kind of thing anyway. It's very Echochrome-y.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it looks quite cool. Again, it's a Wii exclusive, and it's coming out very soon. I think within a couple of weeks, pretty much. So I don't know that it's going to be good, but I think it's going to be worth keeping an eye on. You know, it could turn out to be kind of a sleeper thing. So that's Flip's Twisted World. And Greg is going to finish up here.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm going to go with DKC Returns. Obviously, to some extent, as we've already talked about, Kirby just isn't bloody coming out in Europe. Although I'll have the option to import it from Japan.
But then you won't get to read the pants jokes.
Oh, I already read the pants.
There might be more.
God, bloody missy, it's on the front page of the site all the time. I've got to kind of go with DKC Returns on that basis. Also, in some ways, I've definitely been encouraged by some of the depth to Kirby that's been hinted at with the latest round of impressions, including Aaron's and stuff. But DKC strikes me as, you know, from what I played of it at the London event and all that, could well be the kind of real challenging sort of platform revival that I've been looking for. You know, New Super Mario Bros. Wii was definitely a step up on DS. Yeah. It wasn't all that tricky. So I'm kind of hoping it's going to be challenging. It is the next thing from Retro, which I'm really looking forward to see what they can do in this very different arena. And specifically, Kenji Yamamoto doing the music. I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does with it. You know, obviously the Prime games, I really love those soundtracks. You've got the DKC material to work with, which is very rich in the first place. Probably the thing that stands up the best about those games in retrospect. As I think that could be really cool as well. I mean, I'm probably not going to get much out of the co-op, I wouldn't have thought, you know, because it features that as well. But it does sound kind of cool the way that you can kind of bring the characters together to help, like, DK float over a jump with Diddy, or you can just play kind of completely separately. But, I mean, you're pretty well covered for that sort of stuff with Kirby and the New Super Mario Bros. As well these days.
Yeah.
And then moving on to the next Wii game, because as we mentioned before, Ghost Trick's been moved out. That would have been on my list. The other Wii game I've got is Lost in Shadow, or it's called A Shadow's Tale, I think, in Europe. And the thing about this, a bit of a cheat in a way, because it has been bumped to 2011 in America, but it is at least currently still on course for a European release at the beginning of October. So, you know, pretty shortly. So hopefully there isn't going to be any rug pulling on that one. And so this already out in Japan, actually. And I've read some import reviews that sound really quite encouraging. It's like a kind of 2D platformer where you're playing as a shadow, all the environments are displayed somehow, and then you'll be sort of actually interacting with the shadows of their environments. So sometimes those are kind of displayed in quite a sort of orthodox kind of way, and then other times it might be like a three-quarter perspective. So like the shadows are kind of cast at a kind of weird angles and all that from the original environment, so it's all kind of quite different. You get some like switching puzzles whereby I think you can use the pointer to some extent, and then like sort of change how the light is projected against the actual environment, and then that'll switch how the shadows are, and then you'll be able to get to previously inaccessible areas, things like that. So
yeah.
Looks very sort of Team Eco style, oversaturated.
I would recommend to our listeners, if you haven't seen a video of Lost in Shadow, look it up.
It does look nice.
Once you see it in action, you will be interested in it. Really, it's very, very cool.
It does look very nice. Like I said, it's got that Team Eco kind of oversaturated aesthetic going on. You know, if you haven't played those games like I have, I think like bits of Twilight Princess, which kind of ripped it off. But it does look really striking. And just, it sounds like, apparently, was being compared to the most in the import reviews that I've read, is kind of like the old 16-bit Prince of Persia's in terms of the way that it actually plays, which I haven't played.
They're supposed to be really hard. That's the reputation.
I don't know that it's quite that hard from what I've heard, but that in terms of just how the character handles and stuff, so perhaps that'll be informative for some of our listeners.
Yeah. So for those keeping count at home, that is four 2D platformers so far mentioned.
Yes.
just on the Nintendo platforms. So those are the games we're most looking forward to on Wii and DS. But, you know, we're multi-platform gamers as well. So let's give our honorable mentions for some cross-platform stuff. And James didn't have anything. He couldn't think of anything.
Maybe.
James, I need to ask you this about upcoming multi-platform stuff. I know it's 2010 to factor into it, but I do want to ask this. You've been a very vocal opponent of stuff like Kinect and Move.
No, I've not been a vocal opponent of them. I've mocked them as being me too, which they are. And I think Kinect has more potential than Move does in terms of providing new gameplay experiences.
But Steel Battalion sequel, no controller.
That's a failure. It is.
That is one of the weirdest things I've ever heard. How can you go from over 100 buttons to zero?
It's a magical Kinect.
I love that announcement.
I just want somebody to make a line graph like by years and just have two data points, 100 and zero, and just draw that line going straight down.
So James' most anticipated game of the fall is Kinect Adventures.
Definitely.
Kinectimals,
yes.
Actually, it's close, though. The game that I'm kind of anticipating, but I'm not really sure about it, because, like I've discussed in the past, I never buy games at $60, so it's kind of a moot point for me to really look forward to those games. I'm kind of interested in Front Mission Evolved, but I'm not sure. The demo I played at E3 was interesting, but I don't know how it's going to turn out, basically.
So Front Mission was a tactical RPG.
And this isn't.
No, there's a bunch of them. They started on Super Nintendo or Super Famicom, and then, you know, eventually
there was a weird Super
DS
Famicom, you know, like an action mech game, even back then, that wasn't a strategy game. It was like Gun Hazard, Front Mission Gun. Is it like that?
It's like Mech Warrior, really. I mean, that's this game plays like. But there's a lot of variety in your equipment. So, I mean, I'm interested. I'm not super interested.
It's Western developed, right?
I believe so.
So it really is like MechWarrior.
It could have MechWarrior developers on it for all I know. I mean,
no, that studio doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I mean, employees. I mean, they didn't kill off all the employees when the studio went under.
John, what games were you looking at on other platforms?
There's a couple. Gran Turismo 5, I'm theoretically interested in. It's always one of those, much like Halo. I kind of put it in the same class.
It's good because that game is very theoretical, actually.
Yeah, I put it in the same class.
It's been theoretical for 5 years.
It's in the same class as Halo for me, where I'm always intrigued by it, but I'm kind of weighted. I'll pick the game up and then typically kind of be like, meh, you know, maybe it's not really as interesting as I thought it might be. But I guess with me, I'm enchanted by the idea of Gran Turismo and the scope of it.
The idea.
You know, I mean, it has like, what, like, you know, 15,000 cars, and every single one is, you know, exactly the way it is in real life.
You can play as that that concept car that Nissan made that smiles at you when you start it.
Yeah.
What?
Nissan made
it's a... like a transformer?
the front end has this, like, LED panel on it, and it smiles.
So it's Kit from Knight Rider.
It looks like a 50s refrigerator with wheels.
So the jury's kind of still out. I'm still sort of weighing it, you know.
I'm not that big into racing games, which is why this didn't make my list. But I think the new Criterion game, Need for Speed Hot Pursuit, is much more interesting than Gran Turismo 5. It's kind of Burnout, but it's kind of Need for Speed. It's just like this weird thing, and Burnout is so good. I remember when Burnout came out on Nintendo platforms a long time ago.
Yeah. You mean on the DS?
No, Burnout 1 and 2 were on GameCube.
No.
Yeah, and then they were just like, for no good reason, they're like, eh.
We're done.
All right, John, what else?
Also, you know, I play World of Warcraft, so I'm all obviously very interested in Cataclysm. Just because they're not just adding on content, they're actually kind of revamping all of the old content that really nobody plays much anymore outside of leveling through it. So that should be pretty cool. Also, Little Big Planet 2, I'm also interested in that, just to kind of see where they take it.
I wish there was like a $30 version of Little Big Planet 2 that was just like play only.
Yeah.
Like read-only version without all the damn tools, because the tools scare the shit out of me in that game. My choices for cross-platform stuff, I'll start with Super Meat Boy, which it's a digital download game. It is coming to WiiWare eventually, but I don't know if it's going to make out before the end of the year.
I thought the plan was the end of the year. I thought
okay,
that's what they
maybe.
Were targeting.
It's been delayed so many times that I don't have much faith in that. And I know that some of the features are going to be missing because they've complained about the file size limit, and they should. Everybody should complain about it. But yeah, it's coming out on Xbox first, and that's probably the version I'm going to get. It's actually going to be out, I think, in October.
Yep,
and,
20th.
I played Super Meat Boy for about 5 or 10 minutes at E3, and it is hard as shit. But it's really fun, too. And it's also hilarious. And I don't know if I mentioned it back at E3, but you can, once you finally complete a level, a lot of times the playthroughs are 5 seconds long. I mean, you die, the levels are very short, but they're evil. So you die really quickly and you just immediately start over again. And when you finally beat the level, it will show you a replay of all of your failures at once. And what it is, I mean, it's hilarious. It's totally the kind of game that I could see people hang out in the living room. And you only play one person at a time, but everybody else is having a good time just watching it. Because it's
watching
so absurd.
Die.
And it's totally a pass the controller kind of game. It's like, dude, I can't do this. Here, you try it. It is so old school that that could actually happen in real life. So I thought it was great. Pixel Junk Shooter 2 is apparently coming out soon. I thought this was a little farther out, but I looked at a release list, and apparently Pixel Junk Shooter 2 is coming out before the end of the year, and I am very excited for that. I think the first one is great. It's one of my favorite PS3 games, actually, and it's $10. It's actually might be $5 now. The sequel is basically, you know, it's the game revolves around a lot of physics puzzles and fluids combining and interacting in weird ways and using the fluids to solve puzzles and to kill enemies and things. And so all they really have to do in Pixel Junk Shooter 2 is like add some new fluids in there, you know, like add some new physical elements to it, and the levels practically design themselves. And I think that's basically what it is. I think that maybe that's why it's coming out so soon. But I think, you know, the first shooter is a pretty good value, but you play that and you can clearly see there's a lot more they could do with that concept. There's a lot of room for expansion, and I'm glad they're capitalizing on that because I'm totally ready for more of that. And Vanquish, we sort of mentioned earlier, again, I don't know that Vanquish is going to be good, but I do think it's very
curious. It's going to be interesting.
It's a very curious little game. The demo I had a pretty good time with, so it's going to probably be a rental for me, but it's like this weird mishmash of Devil May Cry and Gears of War. So I'm down with that. You know, I'm interested to play more of it. And Fable 3. I'm not...
Seriously?
I don't know if I'm excited about it.
How did the Kool-Aid taste, Johnny?
Sorry, I really... As you remember, James, I'm sure, I really surprisingly enjoyed Fable 2 a hell of a lot. So I don't know that much about Fable 3. It's not like I have a palpable excitement about it, but I know I'm definitely going to play it, and I'm probably really going to like it if it's anything like the one before. So looking forward to see how that one turns out.
So can I point out a game that none of us mentioned? Because because I think it's telling that none of us mentioned it.
This is really just a big list of games.
I guess it's not really all that surprising given the nature of the game, but it's surprising to me that when I was asked to come up with the list and I was going through these release lists of games coming out, why is Final Fantasy XIV coming out next month and I was unaware it was even coming out this year?
Because it's an MMO?
Well, you know, for one thing, there was already a Final Fantasy game that came out earlier this year.
Yes.
And there's another one coming out for DS this fall, too, so...
Yeah, it's like they've basically said, eh, let's just do it.
I think we've exceeded our quota for MMO talk on this episode. So, Greg, bring us home.
Yep, so the first one of mine for these honorable cross-platform mentions is something that I'm not going to be able to play this year because it's not on a platform I own. It's Bangaio HD Missile Fury.
Nice.
It's perfect subtitle.
It's you know, XBLA exclusive new Bangaio game. It isn't exactly a port
it's not
of
a port.
Any of the... It's not exactly a port of the DS game Bangaio Spirits or the old Dreamcast Last N64 one. I mean, it's got, you know, a big thing in common with Bangaio Spirits from the point of view that you're going to be able to create and share levels.
Right.
Without the modem noises.
I was about to make a joke about that.
Yeah, just get out of the way. The funniest thing about this, I think, is that if there ever been a series that needed dual analog control, it's Bangaio. Yeah. And it's never yes. had it before because it was on the Dreamcast, N64, and DS. You know, I mean, with DS, they did what they could. They did some adroit things with auto-aim and sort of fixing your fire mm-hmm. and stuff to kind of make it work. But obviously, it was kind of straining a little bit under the weight of just having that D-pad to work with. So this should work really nicely on 360. And certainly there shouldn't be such a problem with the slowdown, all that. I've seen the footage of it. It looks nice. And just, you know, they just have the kind of stop for dramatic effect rather than actually, you know, come to a halt as the DS game does. So yeah, it looks really cool. Sorry, I don't have a platform to play it on.
But you're not as sorry as you are about Radiant Silver Gun.
Yeah, this is Treasure's opening salvo in what may prove to be an ongoing war to try and get me to buy a 360.
look, Ikaruga HD looks really nice.
I bet it does. James, I just bought Res HD, and that's a pretty trippy-ass game, too.
Yeah, it is. At this point, Greg, I still kind of have an excuse for why I don't own a PS3 because there's not a lot of exclusives I really want. This is basically just the download service has turned into just completely eroding the base upon which he stands for not owning a 360.
I told Greg earlier tonight he needs an XBLA box.
Yeah, no disk drive.
Get that out of here. I don't need this.
Just some internal memory. That's all I want.
And a modem. That's it. We're good.
An HDMI output or something. That's about all I need. It's kind of annoying.
Oh, it's going to suck not to have a 360.
I can't wait for the week that comes out and we all download it and play it and talk about it in New Business.
Time, we're going to have
good
like
God, this is the best game ever. Anybody who doesn't
well,
own this
all
is
three
a
of us
schmuck.
On the podcast have Radiant Silver Gun. That's all we've been playing because it's the best thing ever.
Now Greg has to end an hour of us talking about
John, you're right. Once again, you're writing checks that you can't cash because you're implying that you'll play again.
The only odds are that I might buy it and maybe John by accident.
Oh, I will buy it and I will play it.
Radiant Silvergun is one of my all-time games that I've never played that I want
to. Yeah, I mean, I've never played through that game. So
if there was a Saturn at PAX, that would be like...
There was a Saturn at PAX.
Did they have... I don't think they had Radiant Silver Gun.
No, they didn't. They didn't have Radiant Silver Gun.
No. If they did, I would have been there
the
entire
weekend. Somebody would have stolen it. That's why I wasn't there.
I've never played it, and I really, 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 really want to play it. Before, that was Steel Battalion used to be one of the top, but I did play that at PAX, so...
Well, I think it's criminal at this point that Greg does not have a 360. So
there is not a single box game on that
that's
system.
The best part.
The
it's just so
about.
If anybody out there has some way that Greg can get a 360, beg, borrow, or steal. If a 360 shows up at his house, we won't ask where it came from.
Just mail me some shoes.
We'll just scrape off any DNA evidence, and Greg will take it inside. And he will enjoy.
I don't want to really make fun, but it is just really bizarre the number of shooters that have come out of
Yeah, it's this weird Japanese market for shooters on 360. You know, I think it's crossed the million unit barrier in Japan now.
Yeah. Well, Bullet Witch started it all.
And apparently that though among those million brave souls that have bought a 360 in Japan, there are enough people who are dependable enough in their appetite for shooters that you could create a whole little cottage industry around this sort of
there's
stuff.
There's like 100 people who play Halo in Japan.
Yeah.
There's like 100,000 who play all these like fucking cave shooters and shit like that.
Yeah.
On 360.
And then the final game that is coming out on a platform that I own is Castlevania Lords of Shadow, which is, you know, Lords. It could be complete rubbish, being that as it is a 3D Castlevania game. The latest round of impressions have been quite positive, actually.
I think it doesn't have to work very hard to be the best 3D Castlevania.
Well, no, but it has to work somewhat harder to be a sort of worthwhile purchase in my book.
Yes.
But like I said, the most recent impressions have been pretty favourable. You've got some really spectacular bosses in it. It looks good. Obviously, it's very sort of God of War-ish.
I was going to say, if you want a demo of it, go buy God
of War
3.
I've played the demo of God of War 3. Yeah, I feel like I've got something of an idea of what it's going to be like.
Yes, you do.
They do say that there's a certain amount of more different kind of platforming elements in it. I know there's some in God of War, obviously. But there's certain aspects of it that feel a bit different. But I mean, I've not played through a whole God of War game, so it's probably going to feel, it could, if it's good, it'll feel fresh to me in any event. I feel similarly about it to probably how a lot of people might have felt about something like Arkham Asylum or War for Cybertron before they came out. Like, well, this, I've heard some encouraging things, but it is...
How could it possibly be good?
Yeah, how could it possibly be good? Which is weird when you consider this is, you know, a series with a video game heritage rather than some weird
licensed
property.
Well, it's not
property.
So weird, though, when you think about the fact that its creator walks around E3 wearing a whip on his side, so...
Well, and he has nothing to do with this game whatsoever.
Which might be right. For the best.
I think the development team of Lords of Shadows might actually have a restraining order against him.
he lands in Spain and the police are notified.
Mercury Steam, whatever, they're based in Spain, and I think they had something to do with that Jericho Clive Barker thing, which is not a good pedigree from everything I understand.
I think that's fine. I don't see
and
a problem.
Then and of course Kojima's kind of overseeing it, which, you know,
which
no he's
troubling.
Not his name's
I assume
on the box.
That just means they have a conference call every now and again and he says needs more talking.
Needs more talking.
All right, so that is going to wrap up our fall preview. I hope you enjoyed it. Let us know what games you're interested in. Our email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. RFN. All right, we're running out of time here, so we're going to have to keep it down to one email this week. I'm sorry. We will try to get in more of them next time, but James is going to read this email from Austin.
So, Austin in Orlando, Florida, a.k.a. Brew Wars, writes, how does RFN crew feel about the growing dependency in Japan on the handheld market instead of the console market? It's always disheartening to see an announcement of a new game in a franchise I really enjoy, for example, Kingdom Hearts, Valkyria Chronicles, etc., and to see it's releasing on the PSP, or even the DS, where I'll never play it, and few people outside of Japan will buy it. With the 3DS, and possibly the PSP 2 on the horizon, it only looks to grow worse. Is there a reason to have hope in the Japanese market supporting the consoles anymore? Or should I just resign myself to primarily playing games from Western studios now?
Well, it's interesting that you guys were mentioning earlier about TGS, that apparently there's like very, very few Wii games there at all.
10. Mm-hmm. Yes. That is a real number. I did not make
that
up.
That's a real... Wow. 10 Wii games at TGS. That's disconcerting.
Yes, I mean, it is. And yeah. a lot of them are in the family section and not even available to play today.
I mean, the Wii is technically still popular in Japan. I know it's not as popular as it was.
It's sold its nearest competitor by 2-1. It's pretty popular.
Mm-hmm. But so how are there more PS3 games? Hell, there are probably more Xbox games. There are probably more than 10 Xbox games at TGS. I bet you there are.
Because
a lot of
be.
These... There's, I mean, you know, Square Enix alone is probably showing 3 or 4 because now they've absorbed Eidos and they're publishing more Western games and they're trying to push those in Japan. And then, you know, Microsoft actually always shows up at TGS with a whole bunch of stuff. And I don't know how much people care, but they show up, which is more than you could say for Nintendo.
Who's never showed up.
I still don't understand why Nintendo doesn't go to TGS. I mean,
too cool for school.
I think now it's just like just a principle thing. Like, we're not going to go.
Yeah, it's a convention. Yeah.
They used to have Space World, of course, and then they haven't done that in ages.
Yep.
And they do always have some kind of media type event around this time. And, you know, of course, we have the September 29th 3DS.
Yeah, but I mean,
conference.
That's not really going to be a big show of games.
I suppose not, but we don't really know.
May
exactly
very well be a big show of games, but they're not going to be showing Wii games at that thing. I really doubt it.
No, they won't be.
So it's going to be purely 3DS, but maybe actually 3DS is part of the answer to this question. Maybe these third parties especially are starting to move resources from the Wii to the 3DS because culturally handhelds are more popular than consoles right now in Japan. They have been for several years. So, you know, maybe they're like, well, we want to make sort of this level of game, but if it takes about the same budget to make it on Wii as opposed to 3DS, it makes more sense to move it over to 3DS where we can probably sell more copies of it. And
especially if it's a launch game, because launch window games tend to sell well because there's not a lot of competition.
Right.
But there's good cultural reasons why those games are more popular in Japan. I mean, part of it is because it's something to do when you're commuting.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to drive to work. Obviously, I should not be playing DS games while I'm driving to work. But if I was riding in the train on a train to work every day, you damn right I'd be playing a game.
Yeah, and I walk to school, which is part of why I listen to so many damn podcasts, because I can't play DS either. You know,
yep. You walk into the street.
I have a commute. I have free time, but I can't be using my eyes and my hands.
Yeah, and I mean, I've never really asked this question, but how many people in Japan actually drive anywhere?
Nobody.
Yeah.
Cars are obscenely expensive, and there's nowhere to park.
There's a lot of bicycling, right?
Yeah, there is. But usually you ride a bike to a train station on a community bike.
Yeah.
I'm serious. There's a lot of that.
Yeah, so I mean, literally cultural differences there. And part of the problem here is that Japanese developers, most of them are still not making games for a worldwide audience. Most of them are still really focused on the Japanese audience, and so they're going to be...
Densha de go.
They're going to be disproportionately influenced by what's popular right now in Japan, even if that don't fly everywhere else. And certainly you can see companies putting tons of resources right now into PSP games that are just, I mean, even Metal Gear Solid Peace Walker really kind of bombed in America. And that's probably a $20 million game. You know, that's not a mini game. That's not a casual game. It was gangbusters in Japan.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, who the heck is going to buy a PSP game for $40? Yeah. I mean, I have a PSP and I'm not going to buy that game. I'm just like, come on. I mean, 3 months from now, I'll be able to get it for $15 at Toys R Us.
Yeah. The PSP is so janked in America. I mean, you know, the new Kingdom Hearts on PSP is not even, they're not even going to sell that on the digital store.
No.
So if you have a PSP Go, you cannot buy that game.
Yeah.
It's absurd. It's stupid. Why the hell
is
that the case?
Yeah, I just feel so bad for anybody releasing anything on PSP in America. Because it's like, I mean, how can they even market their games with a straight face?
Well, they're not. They're using a little boy to do it.
Yeah.
That's right.
I wouldn't call that a straight face.
Steppy but game up.
What I think is interesting is
I like him a lot more than I like the PSP.
Yeah. Is how the West, they kind of took sort of what was going on in Japan and kind of adapted it and also, you know, blended it with kind of what they were doing. And I think that the West has kind of come out ahead in the end, unlike what has happened in other industries like the auto industry, for instance. I mean, also, you know, generally in electronics overall, they kind of took what the West did and did it better, you know, and kind of went off running with it. Whereas,
and it's the opposite now.
It's completely the opposite with the game industry now.
I really feel like the game industry is a lot healthier outside of Japan. I mean, it's just there's more variety, there's more invention, there's more creativity. Japan is the Japanese gaming market is really. It's really turning in on itself. It's like eating itself alive.
Well, especially, I mean, like obviously, if you kind of take Nintendo's growth out of the American like market, that obviously does account for a lot of the growth in the industry.
Right.
But it's not completely decimated by that. Whereas in Japan, if you were to take Nintendo's growth out, I mean, what's
left?
It
would be a disaster. Yeah,
the PS3 is an unmitigated disaster compared to the PS2 in Japan.
But that was the most successful console ever. So, I mean,
I know, but still, I mean,
it's a high bar from which they pissed a lot away.
Yes.
I think going back to the question about how we personally feel about this trend, first of all, I mean, I like portable gaming a lot. I do play it commuting, and I just play it a lot in the settings where, you know, you just haven't got the console on and it's just easier and more casual and more relaxed to play it, you know, while doing something else or half paying attention to something else. Or so I'm perfectly happy to see portable gaming get, you know, bona fide installments in big franchises. And to have the boundaries of portable gaming pushed and perhaps to bring some of the benefits of portability to these established franchises, I see a lot of upsides in that regard. But obviously there are people who just, in a lifestyle sense, just not attuned to portability. And for them, you know, I can see the downside.
Well, I was going to ask, Craig, so you do have a regular commute?
Yes.
Do you see people playing handheld games on those commutes?
Yeah, certainly on, you know, on all sorts of devices. I remember one day we was absolutely crammed into this one train because it was delayed, and there was this man with his arms pinned about an inch away from his face play Wipeout on PSP. God, I don't know how well he's doing, but I admire him for trying under the circumstances. And you know, you see plenty of iPhones and iPod touches and, you know, all sorts sorts of smartphones and DSs as well. I saw someone playing one of the Laytons on an escalator on the tube, actually.
I don't know if you should play video games on the escalator.
I know.
It's personal opinion, but...
You've got people sort of like with their massive suitcases, like sidling past.
Yes.
It's really funny. But yeah, so I mean, you know, definitely it's a big, you know, it's a big part of commuter culture. That's definitely not how I started playing. You know, I started getting into portables long before I was having to commute anywhere. But, you know, for a lot of people, that might be how they get into it. And of course, if you live in certain parts of America or just, you know, the way your job is or whatever, you may never have anything vaguely like that.
Right. I mean, I never play portable games traveling. That's I'm flying to E3, basically.
Yeah, I mean, the flight, yeah.
I usually play DS on my couch.
Yeah, I mean, I play DS sitting on my bed, sitting in my recliner.
And there's still, like I said, there's still benefits to that.
Yeah.
I don't think the portable experience is limited to just, well, you know, do something when you can't do anything else. You know, I mean, I do think there's this cool thing, you have like something like Pokemon. You know, I mean, I wouldn't play that as a console game. But then again, you know, even if I wasn't playing it on commutes, I would be quite happy to just sort of nonchalantly play it here and there at home. So, I mean, to kind of bring some of that to other franchises is fine in my book. I've certainly, you know, stuff like Zero Mission, for instance. I love how portable that is, you know, just because I could kind of fit in little playthroughs wherever.
Yeah, you can play it once on the way to work and again on the way home.
The British transport system is not quite that bad, or the game isn't quite that short to whichever you
there's,
prefer.
There's some Tokyo commutes you could probably do that.
Yeah, perhaps so. I like that part of it. Now, going to the second part of the question, is about, you know, what is there any hope for this trend reversing? This is difficult to see, to be honest. I mean, I think, you know, what Nintendo's done to try and sort of reinvigorate the console market there is really local multiplayer. I mean, Wii Sports, New Super Mario Bros. Wii, you know, that's a big part of what they're doing there. And so if you're looking at like the more traditional kind of cutting edge console experiences, I just don't really see that there's growth in those in Japan. You know, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, and I think the impetus would probably have to come from the outside. You know, that some of these Japanese publishers that are, as we've mentioned, taking American-made or, you know, Canadian or European or whatever else it would be, just Western in general, made games and trying to sell them to the Japanese market. I think probably what you'd have to do is see some of those kinds of ventures succeed to the point where Japanese developers take notice and think, okay, well, there's a market for this and maybe we can serve it as well. But to what extent is that going to happen? That so far they haven't really made much of a dent. You know, your big names like your Halos, your Modern Warfares, your GTAs, they usually have one single solitary week where they kind of...
Well, GTA is probably the most successful out of those.
Yeah.
I wonder if Nintendo has an opportunity to do something about this trend. I mean, obviously they're launching 3DS, so they're going to take advantage of the portable thing in Japan. But Wii was obviously a disruptive type of system. They wanted to disrupt the market in Japan, which they did. They definitely did, probably disrupted it even more in America and Europe and everywhere else in the world. But I wonder if with their next console, they can sort of bridge the gap between what Western developers want from a system and what Japanese developers want. Because Wii is clearly popular around the world, but it's not really popular with Western developers. I mean, it was kind of a fad for them. They were excited about the possibilities and they actually started making games with it. And they're like, wow, this is really hard. And they're not selling. So they gave up on that pretty quickly. And in E3 was a great example. They were fuck all for third-party Wii stuff from Western developers at E3.
Well, in the West, it would have been much more receptive if it would have been on the level of PC graphics, because they're all PC developers for the most part.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's changing as well. That's changing because the PC is falling falling to the background. So the new generation of Western developers is a lot more console-centric. I just wonder if Nintendo can sort of make something that might actually please both sides. You know, maybe the whole idea of basically do the Wii but give it HD graphics, I don't think that's enough. There's got to be something else. And I go back to maybe it's in the development architecture and, you know, the ways that the things that the sort of the tools that you provide and the way the system is made so that it's very easy to make games for it. But I just wonder if there's something they can do to sort of unite the two worlds a little bit, because they seem to be drifting farther and farther and farther apart. And it's weird because it seems like we're actually getting more Japanese games in the West than ever before.
Sure.
You know, there's just, localization is just improving. And access to that stuff is improving.
And the kind of marketing and awareness and all that, you know, I probably feel more confident these days of whether they have a market for something or not based on, you know, the much greater flow of information that we have today.
I'm surprised that Okamiden is even coming out. I mean, I'm surprised it's coming out, period. But I'm even more surprised it's coming out in the West and it's being localized, because Capcom USA hasn't made a dime on Okami. I mean, there's no way they've made any money on either version of that game. So they're really showing a lot of faith to, or something, stupidity maybe, but
balls.
You know, most games that come out of Japan, you can be pretty sure they're going to come over. And that certainly was not the case when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And yet the divide, it's so easy to tell whether a game was made in Japan or not. It's so, I mean, just the style of it, it just seems to get getting farther and farther and farther apart. And it does seem like Japanese games are sort of stagnating.
I mean, there is the wider issue. We talk about lifestyle, but there's also the wider picture of Japan's economy and demography. I mean, you have a sort of aging, declining population, which is certainly different from America. I mean, there's parts of Europe that are going that way. And you also have the fact that they've been in economic stagnation for 20 years. I mean, these things kind of take a toll, really. And, I mean, there isn't the kind of vibrancy to Japan as a nation that there once was. Certainly, you know, when you think of where Nintendo rose to power originally, Japan was, you know, this sort of booming economic juggernaut. Mm-hmm, but that was a long time ago now. And, you know, its position in the gaming industry is obviously, you know, unique, but it's not a right. It's not just, you know, inevitable that it will continue. I mean, in fact, given the wider issues in the country, there perhaps is something inexorable about its decline.
Yeah, it seems like they're getting left behind a little bit. And, you know, you've got executives from companies like Capcom and Square Enix, they're starting to speak up on that. You know, they're concerned about it. They say, we need to get with the program here a little bit. We need to catch up. And they're doing that. I think they're doing a good job of that in general. But the market as a whole is just, it's a really weird.
But there's an interesting kind of fork in the road here relative to what Brood Wars asked in the question, in terms of, you know, the idea of these franchises going portable, or, you know, what would they do? I mean, is the fear that, you know, something like Final Fantasy 13 would just cease to exist? You know, because, well, if the Japanese sort of console market just keeps receding away, and then it's kind of forced to go portable, and so you'll never get anything as lavish as that being produced by a Japanese studio in a beloved Japanese franchise.
It does seem like kind of like an endangered species. I mean, I don't know that it's going
away. Yeah, I mean,
away,
Final Fantasy is a really special case because of the power of that brand, you know. I mean,
but, you know, 13 hasn't sold as well as they wanted it to. It did. I don't even think it sold as well as 12.
And just think of back in the days of the PS2, how many RPGs would be coming out with the scope of that game? There would be a ton of them. They used to be coming out all the time. And now you maybe see one a year now.
But the point for Japanese developers and publishers becomes they sort of have a choice. Do you go portable with these things to try and, you know, capitalize on what Japanese market there is? Or do you focus increasingly more on making it appeal to a Western audience who is actually willing to buy this sort of game?
I think if you look at companies like Namco Bandai, they've tried both approaches. So like their Tail Studios put out a bunch of handheld games. I mean, they still are putting out a bunch of handheld games, and they're not even attempting to bring those to the U.S.
And, you know, maybe with 3DS, you won't have to choose. Maybe you can put it on a portable, but also make it big and, you know, kind of flashy and really pretty and make it appeal to a Western audience. It didn't really work for PSP, but 3DS is a you know, it's a very different beast. So if 3DS is wildly successful in America, there's a chance for that to sort of start to strike at a middle ground. With a system that powerful, I mean, we just found out that Metal Gear Solid 3, that Metal Gear demo that we played at E3 is a port. Well, yeah, it's sort of played, but it is going to be a port of Snake Eater, of Metal Gear Solid 3. So this is such a PSP thing to do. I mean, they are porting a console game to the handheld. This time it's for 3DS. It looks incredible, and that is, I think, easily the best Metal Gear Solid game of the four. But do I really want to play that again on 3DS? I don't know if the 3D alone is enough to make me care. I mean, it's just, like, do I want to play that kind of console game on a handheld? I don't know that I do. You know, this was a huge issue for PSP.
Yeah, that's another interesting sort of problem you've got as well. When you're taking these franchises and maybe you're starting to put them into the portable arena, some people would lament the fact that the game structures might have to be adapted to the portable arena. You know, they might change the way they play, maybe make them more kind of bite-sized in certain ways, you know, and not as extensive. But then on the other hand, if they don't do that, people are going to complain that, you know, well, this isn't really appropriate for a portable game. This isn't really what I want to play on a portable device. So you've got the real problem striking a balance between those two.
You do have to make some design decisions based on the fact that there is going to be some short play sessions.
Well, it's like that God of War game for PSP that was 3 hours long and cost $40. It's like, you know, people are like, this is not what I want to play on my handheld.
This is a demo.
So that's an issue. And that's a very expensive game to make. It's a very complicated situation here. We're almost like discussing an ecosystem at this point.
Well, we are actually.
Broad.
But I think one thing that has to happen for the 3DS is that if they're going to make these games that look really impressive and are big budget titles that look really amazing, Nintendo needs to do the best they can to foster a culture where it's great if you make games like that, but it's also okay to make the lower budget titles that still look good but don't look, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
They need to do their best to make it so those games are acceptable in that sphere.
They did a good job of it on DS. So
they did.
I just hope that they can keep that up. I hope there are $20 3DS games, because the kind of game that is priced at $20, I want it to continue to exist.
Well, I mean, variable pricing is always an issue, and I think, you know, we say with consoles and stuff, but I mean, with 3DS, I mean, there could be such diversity of budgets that go into the different games there, you know, because you could make something really high-end, you know, kind of console level, and on the other hand, you know, there should still definitely be a place for, you know, a 2D kind of game, you know, with just some basic depth of field kind of effects, but 2D gameplay.
And more importantly, I think people will accept that on 3DS.
Yeah, well, you'd hope so. But at the same time, you know, should it be the same price as, you know, something that is basically kind of like a console game on a handheld? It's like, well, no. I mean,
yeah, I agree.
And I don't know whether DSiWare, you know, 3DSware or whatever is going to be robust enough to deliver the kind of flexibility in the market.
I hope so. I hope that gives them the middle ground.
That's the most obvious way, because it's so much more flexible in general. You're not dealing with a box product.
They've really got to do a much better job of organizing that architecture for...
I think we need more notebooks.
All right. We're going to have to cut it off, guys. We could probably keep on talking for another hour about that stuff. Thank you very much to Brood Wars for the great question. And if you'd like to have your question or comment or idea read on the show, we do read everything, even if we don't have time to put it out there on the episode. You can send that to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Now, before we go, I want to mention that we are starting up a new retroactive poll. So you're going to have about a week and a half to vote on this from the time the episode goes out. Make sure you get over to NintendoWorldReport.com. Look for the link on the front page. Should be pretty easy to find. All you have to do is go to our forums and click on the one that you want us to play. And I hope that you will plan to play along as well for whatever game you vote in case it wins. So we are focusing on the Nintendo 64 this time. And all of the games that I picked out from here, and I checked them out with these guys as well. So many of these were requested in the forums in our request thread, and they're all available on either Virtual Console or Xbox Live Arcade, and of course the original cartridge as well if you still have that. So I hope these will be fairly accessible for people to play and not too expensive to get your copy of. So they're going to be Banjo-Tooie, Perfect Dark, Yoshi's Story, oh boy. Wave Race 64, and Ogre Battle 64, Person of Lordly Caliber, right, James?
Yes.
We know which one James is voting for. So it's a pretty eclectic group there. I don't know that there's an obvious winner. I hope there's not. I want it to be a close call always. I hope there's something for everyone to get interested in, and I think it's going to be fun. So head over there, pick which one you like best, and we will talk about it here in a couple of weeks. Also, check out, I believe by the time you hear this, there will be a new episode of the Newscast out. I don't know what's going to be on there, probably some TGS announcements, all this crazy release date shifting around, stuff like that. So go check that out. It's a great show.
Release date earthquake.
Yes, there's a new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition with Michael Cole and Zachary Miller. So if you hopefully you got to play along with the live edition that James here is will have hosted by the time you hear this. And I hope it goes really well. And of course, the podcast rolls on as well. So you've got your radio trivia covered no matter what. Check us out on iTunes. You can give us a little 5-star rating and write a review. And subscribe, of course, if you're not already subscribed. We are on Facebook.com/Radio Free Nintendo, all one word. You can meet other fans, meet us, and I try to, every couple days, I try to post a little something on there, either an announcement or a question or, you know, try to keep some discussion going. So check that out. And again, the email address, tell us anything, ask us anything, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's it, folks. We're done. Thanks very much to James, John, and Greg. I'm Johnny. We out.
Hello, this is Jeffrey, also known as Junior Librarian from the forums, and I'm here to talk to you about PAX. As you heard about 2 weeks ago, I asked Johnny's permission to use his idea of Theremin Hero at the Pitch Your Game Idea panel at PAX. It went much better than I expected. After giving full credit to Johnny, I went on to explain how the game could be used on all three consoles using Kinect, Move, or the normal 2-Wii remote idea that Johnny had come up with about 2 years ago. Jeff Callis sent me through to the second round, but when I came up again, the main concern he had was that no one would buy the game. Eventually, we decided that only about 10 people in the world would buy it, so I was disqualified. However, I made it into the top 10. Thank you to Johnny for letting me use his idea of Theremin Hero and for even mentioning it on the podcast. I'd also like to thank him for letting me record this commercial and have it played on this week's podcast. As always, see you on the other side.
What are you dressed as, next guy?
Dr. Horrible.
I was going to go Joel Hodgson.
Yeah, everyone dresses as a white suit, so I decided I would go for the evil version.
Okay, oh yeah, okay. Yeah.
I was actually going to guess Bash the Stampede, but I think I'm wrong.
Okay, I actually have two comments.
The first, I've got the belts.
As you may have guessed, I wasn't actually alive when the NES came out, but Retronauts and Radio Free Nintendo are the two things that made me go get an NES that still works, so I'm playing all the old games now. My second one is, you have the best retro. Can there also be another competition for the worst piece of shit that someone has in here? I have Shaq Fu.
You are in first place with a bullet, my friend.
what prize does he win? Do we give him a consolation hug?
I haven't thought
about
that.
He can have the get back from Mike paper. He can go home with us. We'll all sign it. Get back from Mike. This is strategy for Punch Out. Mm-hmm. Get back from Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd have the patience to relearn the controls now.
Yeah, it's tough for me to see the payoff. It's tough. It's tough, especially when I could probably buy SSX for like $2 somewhere.
$2? So, probably. You know,
if I can find it. That's the thing. I don't even know if I can find it.
Oh, you can find it. Believe me.
Deal Machine, ho! Come on, Deal Machine.
Oh, that's a good point. I haven't done one in a while.
What happened to Dealey?
Yeah, Dealey. Dealey's dead.
Took him out back and shot him.
I got a really bad draw last time, and I was like, this thing is broken. I can't write about these games.
Every single one of them was Castlevania Judgment.
It was like four games where I'm like, I can't write about any of these. I can't even be factual about these games. I just don't care. I'll try again this month. But
you got past the pigs yet?
I don't even think past the pigs is in the database. I cheated and cracked it open to see what was still left in there. I'm like, am I just scraping the bottom of the barrel? I have two important pieces of information to disseminate about this game now that we've talked
about
it.
Please disseminate.
While it was produced by Nintendo EAD, its programming team were...
Giles Goddard.
Yes. So I'm not sure who or where it was produced specifically, or if it was one of those like split-up development processes. And this game actually won an Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences award.
What award did it win, James?
It won...
Best controls.
The Interactive Achievement Award.
Best likes.
Best generic English character in Dion Blaster.
Dion Blaster. It's a common surname in England.
Dion as well, very common for now.
Plenty of blasters in Manchester.
Prime time. There's a lot of people high stepping to the telephone button.
He's just like, oh.
Dude, legit.
Okie doke. So
I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah, post dick a fork in it.
Well, all right. Moving on.